Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I was not the smartest man in my class. I was mediocre. And I'm willing to bet that most of you that are leading today, you were not the best in your class. You were mediocre. But what happened to the top of the class? It's gone. It's dead. It's in jail. It's on drugs. It's destroyed. Got through, we're more submissive. We submitted to our teachers, and we let them bend us and mold us, and the more we looked like we accepted the bending and the molding, they applauded us, they patted us on the back, they gave us a star on the forehead, they gave us a passing grade. So you become the first Negro to do this, or the first Negro to do that, or the first Negro on Channel 5, or the first Negro on Channel 7, or the first Negro.
There's no brighter spotlight in American fashion than the September issue of Vogue. Landing its cover has historically been uncommon for non-white celebrities or models. Now singer Beyoncé has not only landed her second, she's leveraged her star power to nudge Vogue into doing something it had never done in its 125 years, have a black photographer do the cover shoot. 23-year-old Tyler Mitchell earned that spot. He's here to talk more about it. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
So we had heard these reports that Beyoncé wanted an African-American photographer, and then we've heard that Anna Wintour, the editor-in-chief, was the person who selected you. What can you tell us about how this came about?
I think it was very much a collaborative effort. I think to give a little origin story, I've worked with Vogue a couple times before, so I think my name was familiar with Condé Nast, and I think my name was also maybe familiar with Beyoncé's team because I'd worked with Solange. But from what I understand, it was Vogue who first called me and proposed me to her, and she quickly approved and said yes and was excited to work with me.
So you've done some print pages, you said. You've done Teen Vogue. Mm-hmm. But it's a different deal to do the cover, right? Especially to do September, and you're only 23. I mean, for people who are not photographers, how big a deal is this?
It's huge. Photographers live their whole life to shoot this cover slot in this month. But I think I kind of approached it with a kind of practicality of trying to shoot her like how I would shoot my friends. So it was beautiful and nerve-wracking and exciting all at once.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I can imagine. You sound like semi-calm and semi-giddy, like you still can't believe it happened.
I can't. I mean, I just got the print magazine yesterday.
What?
So I didn't even think it was real until I saw it actualized, like in physical form. So I'm still kind of beside myself right now.
You're not only the first African-American to shoot the cover for Vogue, but you're also one of the youngest. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to you to have this kind of start, to have this place in the fashion history?
It's kind of, you can't really put words to it, right? I keep thinking about the moment they called me and told me about the shoot, and they made me aware that I would be the first African-American to shoot the cover of Vogue. It was at once totally unreal and also felt like I had been living my whole life to receive that call. So I think there's a level of amazing kind of magic to it. And then there's also kind of, this is exactly what, you know, we've been working towards to really, you know, we should be shooting covers of Vogue month to month, not just as a first.
Can I ask, in this industry, did that feel like something that was unattainable, or did that feel like a door that just wasn't open to Black and brown photographers?
I never looked at it as a door that I couldn't open. I actually have always looked at it as a door that I was very much going to open.
But 125 years is a long time. You know what I mean?
An like, insanely long time.
We're not talking about a banking institution. We're talking about a magazine. So, you know, why do you think that was?
The beautiful part of 2018 is that photography is becoming so amazingly democratized. I mean, I think we're talking about a history of magazines and photography, and it was known as a rich man's art, so it was mostly for white men who were able to afford all of the chemicals, the films, the cameras that went into it in the very early stages. So it's a historical thing that goes into why there just haven't comparatively been as many Black fashion photographers as white fashion photographers. But the part that I can't answer is why they haven't been recognized, the amazing Black photographers and Black fashion photographers that have been shooting. That I can't answer you.
But it's an interesting point you're making about the democratization, right? And I'm sure Instagram
is a
huge part of that. Like just about anyone with some kind of camera, technically even your phone, could establish a career. Do you think that's true?
Absolutely. The iPhone is the thing that opened up everything. I mean, the beautiful thing about now is that it's no longer somebody who can afford the best camera, but it's about what your eye says.
It also means that someone like you, right, you are unrepresented. You don't have a creative agent, right? And yet you've already shot brands and done major publications. Do you think you need one?
At a certain point, you definitely need a team. I mean, I've been a one-man show for a long time. And you ask any of my friends, they could tell you I really focus in and work very hard. So I think it's been so beautiful to really promote my work through Instagram, promote my work through the web, which I think is like the new ladder, I call it, of like we had a ladder of photographers who they shot for certain magazines and then they shot for better magazines and they worked their way up a ladder. And I think now we have a new ladder of a world that's focused on young emerging voices that have something interesting to say. So when you talk about not having a creative agent, I think Instagram it has the ability to be your agent as a young photographer. But I think after a certain point, you need a team, too. It's about what's best for you.
I would say that point for you is probably now, after a Vogue cover shoot.
Definitely, yeah.
So some people may be familiar with your work on Instagram, but when did you first start shooting pictures?
I actually started making videos first. I was montaging skate videos for friends.
This is just you and your friends at like skate parks or?
Yeah,
like...
we actually had a DIY skate park ourselves. There was like a plot of land in Atlanta where I'm from. And so we'd film all day there and then I would go home and edit them and do my own coloring. And then I was kind of like the director of my own movies. So that was the start. But photography really became a serious thing for me after I took a trip to Cuba. I lived there for a little over a month. And
and you're 23 now, so how old are you when all this is happening?
That was 2015, so I must have been 20.
Okay.
I was always taking pictures, even back to 14 and 13 years old, but it really became serious when I started to put together this photo book idea in my head of documenting the architecture in Havana, Cuba, and the skate scene in Havana, Cuba, which was emerging at the time.
Now, you are not the first photographer to fall in love with Havana, right?
Not at all.
In Cuba.
But I think that's the beautiful part. I think I've seen so many amazing pictures in Havana, and I think even when you look at my book versus other books, it's always going to be different pictures of maybe the same city, and that's kind of the amazing takeaway as I realized my point of view very much there.
So how does this come into play in terms of your style? What I notice are people in your photos, it's usually natural light, usually black and brown subjects, often wearing kind of bold colors. You shoot in color. How did this experience help you develop your images?
It started there as a place that kind of imagined in my mind in Havana that I didn't know existed. But I think it then extended to me trying to recreate that color palette in all my work because it kind of has to do with, I guess, an autobiographical sense of how I feel. There's a lot of, in my work, the black body's searching for an idyllic space. And I think the use of vibrant color, the use of natural light, the way that that kind of colors and taints black and brown skin to me feels a lot of how I feel. I mean, I think a lot of photography is trying to embody the complexity of who you are, who you think you are, as Arthur Chaffee says. So I think for me, that style comes from Havana, but also from my ideology of black and brown bodies deserving to kind of live in an idyllic space.
We've mentioned you're being 23 years old and you've accomplished so much in this moment. Where do you see yourself going from here?
I think that's a beautiful question because I think it's only the beginning. I think it's been a huge door opener in terms of being able to collaborate with people I've been wanting to collaborate with. And I think I'm focused right now on a lot of art-centric projects and a lot of film-centered projects. I don't know if I can talk too specifically, but it's been a great door opener. It's really just the beginning, so.
Well, Tyler Mitchell, thank you so much for sharing this moment with us.
Thank you so much. I'm glad I could share that.
Photographer Tyler Mitchell, he's the first African-American to shoot a cover for Vogue. It'll begin hitting newsstands this week.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. 30 years ago, two seminal hip-hop albums were released to the world, changing the history of music forever. The albums Straight Outta Compton by N.W.A. and It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back by Public Enemy brought to the masses issues of inner-city crime and police brutality in the black community. St. Louis Public Radio's Chad Davis speaks with three local music experts on the cultural significance of the two albums.
That's the song, Show 'Em What You Got, from Public Enemy's It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, the group's second album, which came out 30 years ago. I sat down with several hip-hop enthusiasts, including Franchise Cunningham. He explains what he remembers of the albums when they came out and why they're so significant.
I was a senior in high school, so I remember this very vividly. It was, a movement. Both rap groups were just amazing at the time, so yeah, it was a great time in music for me.
Cunningham has worked with Roz Norman, a professor at Webster University teaching hip-hop entrepreneurship. Norman was living in Southern California in 1988 and remembers the socially aware messages that both groups brought into the mainstream.
At that time, they were the voice for the voiceless. They were the ones that were like the journalists of what was happening in their neighborhood or the hood. And they were real about it. You know, so if you want to look at semantics, some people get upset because they say, oh, they use a lot of profanity and all this. I said, but you have to go back to the time, give it context, understand the background.
I wanted to know how later artists were inspired by these albums. James Biko, a local DJ, had this to say.
You know, without Straight Outta Compton, without It Takes a Nation's Millions, we wouldn't have The Chronic. And then we wouldn't have Doggy Style. And then we wouldn't have, you know, Tupac's catalog. And then we wouldn't have Kendrick. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Without It Takes a Nation of Millions, pretty much the same thing, but also we wouldn't have Brand Nubian. We might not even have Tribe. These definitely help with the, you know, trajectory of more people, like we said, descending.
While N.W.A. was creating records on the West Coast, the group Public Enemy were in New York doing their own thing. Cunningham explains that it wasn't just the locations that differentiated them.
N.W.A., they didn't care. They just came out and was like, this is who we are, like us, or forget about us, you know. But we're here, and this is what is going on in our community, and we want to express that. Public Enemy, I think, were more mature, more strategic in their movement.
Both N.W.A. and Public Enemy created a new hip-hop sound. Norman says the L.A.-based N.W.A. resonated across the country, but especially in St. Louis.
Even though you were dealing with what was going on in South, you know, Central, you know, around Compton and all that, dating back to the time, even the period when I was out there, what I'm getting at is it's still here. I'm looking at the fact the cycle continues to repeat itself. It's still here because that's Ferguson. Okay? That's Ferguson. When you sit there and think about that.
That's the song Frontline by local artist MC Keem. He recorded it after the protests in Ferguson, and just like NWA and Public Enemy, he's bringing issues of police misconduct to the masses by using socially conscious and relevant lyrics, the same type of lyrics that help propel hip-hop to be the number one genre in the world. The fact that genre is now number one, according to Billboard, isn't a surprise to Norman, Cunningham, and Biko. They reflect how these two albums contributed to hip-hop's dominance.
They're definitely part of the foundation.
Yeah, they're definitely part of the conversation. They laid the foundation for the future.
It's not just them, obviously, right. But yes, definitely. Those two albums are critical in the conversation about the ascension of hip-hop.
I'm Chad Davis, St. Louis Public Radio.
I was born 1911, Chickasaw County, Piedmont Plantation.
And did you know as a girl growing up that one day you'd be a maid?
Yes, ma'am, I did.
And you knew that because?
My mama was a maid. My grandmama was a house slave.
Do you ever dream of being something else? What does it feel like to raise a white child when your own child's at home being looked after by somebody else?
It feels... I done raised 17 kids in my life. Looking after white babies, that's what I do.
Anyone with children knows that full-time child care can be very expensive, running up to tens of thousands of dollars per year per child. Some have turned to a less costly alternative, the State Department's Au Pair program, which allows young people to come to America on a J-1 cultural exchange visa. They live with families providing child care for a flat fee, regardless of the number of children. This month, a trial date was set in a class action lawsuit brought on behalf of au pairs. The suit charges that what began in 1986 as a cross-cultural experience has devolved into a system providing cheap, exploited labor. NewsHour Weekend's Yvette Feliciano has more.
Ali Petchek is a stay-at-home mom in New Rochelle, New York. She has three boys, ages 1 through 8. She says she's enjoyed hosting 7 different au pairs from all over the world over the last 6 years. Petchek estimates she and her husband, Charles, have spent roughly $20,000 a year on the au pairs who work 45 hours a week. She says that kind of money would get them only about 3 to 4 days a week of part-time childcare from a nanny or babysitter.
Getting help helped our family to function better, I'll say. But the other thing that really interested me about the au pair program was the cultural exchange part of it.
Okay, and when Teddy's done with the brush, Liam, you can do that. Okay.
21-year-old Marisol Pelaez-Jaquez is from Mexico and works for Petchek and her husband. She is one of the roughly 20,000 college-aged individuals, mostly women, who work as au pairs for U.S. families. Both the family and Marisol pay fees to the sponsor agency to participate in the au pair program.
I just think, like, it's an experience that, like, helps you grow up so much. You're completely out of, like, your comfort zone, and you get to see another side, like, another culture and another family and another tradition.
Marisol is working, but is being an au pair actually a job? That question is at the heart of a class action lawsuit that threatens to upend the way the entire au pair system operates. The U.S. Department of State runs the au pair program, not as a labor program, but as a cultural exchange program.
Bye, boys. Listen to Marisol.
It contracts with 16 private sponsor agencies to recruit au pairs, match them with host families, and make sure everyone understands and follows the rules.
Do you think most people see this as a cultural exchange program, or do most host families see this as a source of child care?
I think the majority of host parents do see it as a cultural exchange, because I really don't think it works if you don't. Otherwise, I think both sides will be unhappy. Because these are not professionals. And I've been told by my au pairs that the sponsor agencies play up the fun aspect of it.
I think Allie was very honest, and she was like, look, working with kids, it's hard. Like, it's not the same as babysitting 2 hours. The fact that you're with them for a whole day, it's really tough.
One of the regulations requires employers to adhere to Department of Labor rules regarding au pair wages. The federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. However, sponsor agencies say families are allowed to deduct 40% for the food and housing they provide, meaning Marisol's pay works out to $4.35 an hour, or $195.75 a week. That pay rate is at the center of the lawsuit, representing 90,000 current and former au pairs. The suit claims that rather than being cultural ambassadors, the au pairs are cheap migrant labor, exploited by a system that grossly underpays them for what amounts to ordinary domestic employment. The defendants in the suit are 15 of the 16 agencies charged with oversight of the program. The agencies deny that au pairs are exploited.
We're talking about a workforce that's working incredibly hard and still not able to make ends meet doing this work.
Ai-Jen Poo is director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which advocates on behalf of more than 20,000 members who work inside homes, including au pairs.
They are here working as caregivers in the homes of the families who've hired them. These women who are here on J-1 visas have really been taken advantage of in many cases and treated as less than real workers.
Massachusetts has more than 1,500 au pairs. Poo's organization co-authored a report that surveyed former au pairs here at Boston's Mata Hari Women's Worker Center about their experiences with the program. Two of the women now work as nannies and asked us to conceal their identities out of fear of retaliation and loss of their livelihoods.
And it's just like, it's just using you, that you were here to serve me. That's how I felt most of the time.
Both these women say they went thousands of dollars into debt to pay for the interview fees and applications to get in the au pair program. They each claim that host families routinely ask them to work illegal overtime hours and that the sponsor agencies and the federal government were not paying attention.
This family made me work up to 65 hours a week, promised me that they will pay me for the extra hours that I was working. And I'd rather to have more money to be able to save, and that's what I did. Also, those extra time that I was working, I was doing housekeeping. It was nothing relative of childcare.
She says her host family never paid her for those extra hours. Among other things, the suit filed in 2014 alleges that you can't legally deduct 40% from the minimum wage for room and board if the program requires au pairs to live with families, which it does. That agencies colluded to keep au pair wages low, an allegation they deny, and that at least four of the agencies violated federal labor rules that say families must pay their state's minimum wage if it is higher than the federal minimum wage. A spokesperson for one of the agencies, Cultural Care Au Pair, disputes that contention. He sent PBS NewsHour Weekend the most recent State Department notice regarding stipends, which is from 2007. He says the State Department has never told the sponsor agencies that employers must meet state minimum wage requirements. The State Department, however, told NewsHour Weekend sponsors must adhere to state and local laws. Among other things, the plaintiffs' attorneys are asking for what they say are unpaid wages and the return of illegal deductions. They estimate total damages at more than $2.5 billion. PBS NewsHour Weekend reached out to all 15 of the 16 agencies named in the suit, but none were willing to speak to us in an interview.
There is so much that's wrong about the allegations of the lawsuit that it's hard to know where to begin.
C.V. Harquail is the founder of Au Pair Mom, a blog for host families. She says since au pairs are provided with housing, food, and many amenities, the weekly stipend usually just serves as pocket money. She also believes that ultimately, the lawsuit was spurred by what she considers to be the State Department's lack of clarity.
It isn't the agencies who've set the minimum wage requirement. I think that what would really change the program one way or another would be clearer and more expansive regulation or more deliberate and concerned oversight governmentally.
The State Department does not spell out how federal wage regulations should specifically apply to au pairs. In a statement to NewsHour Weekend, they also declined to weigh in on that 40% deduction for room and board. They say simply that sponsor agencies should make sure families understand their obligations. Usually, wages are the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor, but it doesn't oversee the program. One change domestic worker rights advocate Ai-Jen Poo believes is necessary.
It is just hugely challenging for most American families to afford childcare. So we need more care, but our policies and our programs haven't caught up to that. I think the answer is more of a systemic answer that allows for families to be able to afford childcare much more universally, rather than take advantage of these caregivers who are here for learning and education and cultural exchange and end up getting exploited with poverty wages.
Host mom Ali Pechek says there is no question the au pair program has been an immersive cultural experience for her family. On this day, she, Marisol, and the boys were welcoming back a former au pair who was visiting from Germany.
Honestly, she's like a member of our family. I'm still in touch with all my au pairs, even the ones who didn't work out. They've become like my daughters, which is kind of nice because I only have sons.
A trial by jury for the class action lawsuit is set for next February. Pechek says she is watching developments closely.
I'm conflicted. I can see absolutely why they would think they're not getting paid very much. But on the other hand, if they win their lawsuit and the agency passes that increase on to us, I can see a lot of families dropping out of the au pair program and not being able to continue. And I think that would be a shame.
If I'm a slave, call me a slave. Don't tell me that I'm a free person and I'm still a slave. Yeah, that really lulls me to sleep. You're not really a slave, you know. You're a co-worker. You know, you're a member of the firm, you know. This is the Bodie Plantation, you know. And you are one of our business associates. Now, get that plow moving. Now, boy, I'm really working out now. I mean, boy, the sweat is flying, whatnot, and I'm behind that mule and I'm grinning. I'm a business associate at the Bodie Plantation. Man, I feel great. Get up, mule.
So you, as long as the system of white supremacy exists, you don't see...
Word master.
Joining me as always is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and Weekend Edition's very own Puzzle Master. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Lulu.
So, Will, we are in the middle of a two-week challenge. It has two parts. You gave us the first part last week. Why don't you remind us of that first part now?
Yeah, and you'll need to solve both parts in order to send in the answer. And part one was, I said, write down these four words, Neanderthal, embarrass, saturation, and contemptuousness. And I said they have a very interesting and unusual property in common, something hidden in them. What is it?
We'll hear the second part of that challenge at the end of this segment. But until then, let's play the puzzle with a special guest this week. And I can't tell you how much joy this brings me to say this.
Oh.
Weekend Edition Saturday host.
Oh.
Let's say something.
What? Oh, hi. Hi there. Hi there, Lulu.
Yeah. Oh, Scott Simon, welcome to the program.
The guy who does the astrology podcast wasn't available, right?
I have to say, you walked in here looking a little bit...
I'm scared to death. This is the hardest thing to do in broadcasting. I have been trying to avoid it for many, many years. Usually, I feign some kind of grievous illness. But in this case, they said you wanted me to do it, so I said, why not?
Yes, indeed. All right. Will, are you ready to have our guest play the puzzle?
I am ready.
All right, take it away.
I'm going to give you two words.
Yeah.
Rearrange the letters in each of them to make new words. Then think of a familiar saying or proverb that contains both those words.
Okay.
For example, if I said cheat, C-H-E-A-T, and God, G-O-D, you'd anagram those words to make teach and dog, and then you'd say you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Well, you would.
It
would take me a long time to get there, but thanks for the benefit of the doubt. Okay.
Number one, cool, K-O-O-L,
yeah.
And pale, P-A-L-E.
Look.
There you go, and pale?
I'm trying to think. Pale. Leap.
There you go. And what's the saying?
Oh, look before you leap.
Look before you leap.
Oh,
there you
right.
go.
Okay.
You're off and running.
Do I get a lapel pin now?
You get that lapel pin already.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Number two.
Yeah.
Emit, E-M-I-T.
Yeah.
And vases, V-A-S-E-S.
Oh, my word. Time.
Yes.
Time and, oh, my word.
Just switch the V and the S.
That saves?
Yes, and what's the saying?
Time and say, Lulu's making all these grimaces and gestures.
I'm trying to
help me, and I'm thinking.
I'm miming.
I've never heard that phrase.
A stitch in time saves nine.
Thank you. You know Lulu. That one. Okay, here's your next one. Top.
My next one? What your did I possibly do to deserve a next one? Go ahead, yeah?
Top, T-O-P.
Yeah.
And nerve, N-E-R-V-E.
Okay. So that would be pot, right?
Yes, yes.
And never.
There you go. Uh-huh. You got pot and never. What's the saying?
A watch pot never boils.
There you go. All right. Your next one is throw, T-H-R-O-W, and hubs, H-U-B-S.
Worth?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And?
Starts with B.
A bush.
There you go.
A bird in hand is worth two in the bush.
There you go. Nice. Here's your next one. Deal, D-E-A-L, and more, M-O-R-E.
So lead or lead. Lead.
Lead, yes.
Okay. Rome?
Yes.
All roads lead to Rome.
That's it. Good.
How many more do we have, Will? Oh, never mind.
Oh, let's jump to the last one. Here you go. Tow, T-O-W, and shade, S-H-A-D-E.
Okay. W-O-T.
Does not start with a... There, huh? Yeah.
Two.
Yes.
God bless. And Hades.
Yeah, not Hades, though, but it does start with H.
Two heads are better than one.
There you go. Good job.
As they are.
Oh, God bless. Thank you, Lulu. That was, yes. Thank you very much.
He did it. He came to the end. Okay, Will.
This is a lot of work for a lapel pin. I'm telling you.
This is it. You're not getting a lapel pin, though. We're giving you... puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Scott, what member station do you listen to?
I think I'm going to go with WBEZ Chicago.
There you go. Our Saturday show host, Scott Simon. Thank you for playing the puzzle.
My pleasure. And I love being with you, Lulu, but let's make certain this doesn't happen for a long time, okay? All right, Will. Nice talking to
nice
you.
Nice job, Scott.
Will, we're in the middle of a 2-week challenge. We've got 1 week left. Can you tell us the second part of that challenge?
Yeah, part two. Write down these four words. Scarecrow, screensaver, camera woman, and curvaceousness. And they have a very interesting and unusual property in common. Something about the letters in them. All the letters in this case. What is it? And when you know it, think of a common 7-letter word that shares the unusual properties in both last week's and this week's words. So again, this week's words are scarecrow, screensaver, camera woman, and curvaceousness. These share a very interesting and unusual property, something about the letters in them. What is it? And when you know what it is, think of a common seven-letter word that shares the unusual properties in both last week's and this week's words.
Will, you are on fire. That sounds very hard.
Here it is. Bam. And you say, God damn, this is a dope jam. But let's define the term called dope.
Today, about 2% of infants are born drug dependent, and doctors are rethinking how to care for them, including the way hospitals facilitate mother-infant bonding. For member station KCUR in Kansas City, Alex Smith reports.
When Victoria was pregnant with her fourth child, she was addicted to heroin and hated herself for it.
If you are in withdrawal, you feel your baby uncomfortable inside of you. And then you use, and then the baby's not. And that's a really awful, vulgar, like, thought, but it's true.
In her third trimester, Victoria started recovery using methadone. We're using only her first name because she's used illegal drugs. When her daughter Lily was born, the newborn was started on morphine to help ease her withdrawal symptoms, like clenched muscles and a high-pitched scream. Victoria was allowed to hold, feed, and care for her daughter at the hospital during those first few difficult weeks. The treatment they got is fairly new. Dr. Jody Jackson treats newborns with critical health problems in the neonatal intensive care unit of Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. Jackson explains that a ward like this, armed with high-tech beeping medical monitors, is not where newborns like Lily belong.
What happened 10, 15 years ago is babies exposed were immediately removed from the mom, and they were put in an ICU in a warmer with bright lights with nobody holding them. You know, of course, they're going to be upset about that. And so the risk of withdrawal is much higher in that situation.
Jackson has worked for years to address infant mortality in Kansas and is now heading a statewide effort to get hospitals to use science-based treatment methods for neonatal abstinence syndrome, like keeping mothers and infants together in the hospital and providing recovery drugs to reduce withdrawal symptoms. Jackson says she's starting from scratch in many parts of the state where there are no standard treatment approaches, and bias against drug users sometimes keeps mothers and infants apart.
That is probably one of the most damaging approaches that there is, because it's not helping the woman and it's not helping the baby.
But improving outcomes for opioid-dependent babies will probably take more than just educating hospital staff. Dr. Alicia Walkman teaches pediatrics at Boston University.
It really depends on the capacity of the hospital. Some of them don't have rooms available for the mothers to stay with the baby.
And there's still plenty of debate about what is best for these babies. For example, new research suggests that methadone may be a better recovery drug for newborns than morphine, which Walkman says is most often used. But doctors are still unsure about long-term effects.
There's very few high-quality clinical trials that have been done in this population of infants. If you can imagine, this is an incredibly difficult population to study.
Dr. Jackson acknowledges the challenges, but she says establishing consistent practices based on what doctors do know is an important first step. For Victoria and her daughter Lily, staying together in the hospital was key, even though Victoria had no idea what would happen next.
I was trying not to be connected with her because I thought they're probably going to take her. You know, I haven't been clean that long, so I was trying to not, like, be in love with her, but that didn't happen. Like, I was so in love with her.
But Victoria showed state officials that she was committed to her recovery. She's been allowed to raise her daughter at Amethyst Place, a recovery home in Kansas City.
Patty cake, thank you.
Today, Lily is a 16-month-old who shares her mother's blonde hair, bright eyes, and big smile. The picture of good health. And her mom has been sober for more than a year and a half. For NPR News, I'm Alex Smith in Kansas
August
City.
8, 40 years of resistance. It seems incredible, but it's been 40 years since the police assault on the Move House in West Philly. 40 years. 40 years since Rizzo's cops fired hundreds of rounds into a home in Powden Village trying to kill Move members. 40 years since Delbert Africa was kicked, rifle-butted, and slammed with a helmet by cops who only went on to be acquitted despite videotape evidence. 40 years ago, a beautiful baby boy was born to Debbie Africa in a Philadelphia County jail cell. For three precious days, mother and child shared each other's company before jail guards discovered the birth and the two were separated. That boy is now a man, Mike Africa Jr. And several weeks ago, he drove his mother home, and mother and son were reunited. As he looked at his mother the next day, he realized that this was the first time he'd ever seen his mother's feet in his 39 years of life. For 40 years, from August 8, 1978 to today, MOVE members have demonstrated, protested, petitioned, and spoken out against the unjust imprisonment of MOVE members. These protests continue until all of them are free. MOVE, still on the move after 40 years. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Last week when I was in England at Oxford University, we had a debate at the Oxford Union. And before the debate, I was with several of the students. We were discussing a variety of things for a couple hours at a dinner. And at the end, toward the end of the dinner, a girl that had been one of the diners pointed out, she said, "You know, you're just not what I was looking for." So I asked her, "What were you looking for?" I knew what she was looking for. She was looking for the horns that had been created by the press. And those horns mean she was looking for someone who was out to kill all white people, who was a segregationist, a rabble-rouser, an irrational, an extremist, subversive, seditious, someone who couldn't hold a conversation with just anyone. This is what she was looking for, because she was looking for something whose image she only knew from what she had read by a very biased press, a press that has perfected image-making to a science. And then they use these images to make people love whom they will and hate whom they will.
We're going to have a conversation now that may seem a bit ironic. It's a debate playing out in op-eds and in newsrooms over how media outlets should cover the white supremacist movement in this country. NPR, CNN, The New York Times have all come under criticism at one point or another for giving white supremacists a platform. So on a day like today, as the second Unite the Right rally takes place outside the White House, how should media organizations handle this story without fanning the flames of racist viewpoints? Karen Grigsby-Bates of NPR's Code Switch team has been thinking about this question, and she joins us now from Culver City, California. Hello, Karen.
Hey, Lakshmi.
So I'm curious. Obviously, we've been covering the Unite the Right rally happening here in D.C. When newsrooms are deciding how many or even whether to send reporters out to events like today's, what are some of the factors that you think media organizations should weigh?
Well, I think they have to weigh whether or not you're normalizing these groups by affording them the same space and the same time as legitimate news. And there have been questions. You know, reporters have had questions. Why should we give airspace to hate groups that are craving the attention? Does that do anything other than stir them up? Are you going to create an incident by giving them coverage as opposed to leaving it be? I think it's a hard line to walk.
It is, because I think that begs the question of balancing perhaps responsible restraint in the way that one covers a story mm-hmm. and censorship, which is the thing that we all dread. We don't want to be accused of censoring information that the general public believes we have a responsibility to share with people who listen or read our material.
Sure. On the other hand, you do have people who say, you know, listen, we understand you're journalists. We understand you think there's two sides at least, maybe multiple sides to every story. But some things do not have a side that needs to be covered. How do you argue that you need to cover the other side of genocide? Shouldn't happen. What are you doing? On the other hand, if you don't cover it, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And maybe covering it shows the extent of the horror in the case of genocide and perhaps can go to trying to stop it or mitigate it.
Media organizations have been grappling with the question of whether to give white supremacists a platform. And we know that NPR aired an interview with Unite the Right organizer Jason Kessler on Friday. That drew a lot of criticism. What have you been hearing from other reporters and people, listeners, who've generally been following your work about these alt-right and white supremacist gatherings, how they should actually be covered? What kind of ideas have you been hearing?
Some people, and these are usually people who are not journalists, say, what happens if you just ignore them? You know that's what they want. They want your attention. They want to be on the radio. They want to be on television. They crave this. So why are you giving it to them? Just ignore it. And maybe the numbers fall away. It may not go away completely, but maybe the numbers fall away. I don't know if anybody's really tested out that thesis, unless you think about something like Westboro Baptist Church, where in the beginning, you know, a handful of people would show up at the funerals of military personnel that they had decided were gay with horrible signs, you know, opposite their church, their cemetery. And it got a lot of coverage, both on television, newspapers, radio. After a while, I think those media organizations decided, they're so fringe. Why are we doing this? And so you don't see a media presence there anymore. Maybe that's the way to go. I don't know. One person who was not a journalist, but who I thought had a really interesting idea said, why don't you all treat this the same way you treat like a war or the president? Everybody doesn't go in and cover those things. Lots of times they'll have pool coverage. Why can't you have pool coverage of these people so that there's one piece of tape, one visual image that you get, and that's enough of these guys? I don't know where it stops.
As we're speaking, I'm looking at images on television, on CNN, and it's the angle, the camera angle shows a lot of other videographers, cameras, and then you have the crowd further up. And from this angle, it's tough to tell if there are more journalists than protesters in this particular scene or the other way around.
And sometimes in many of the things we've covered, there are more of us than there are of the people who were the actual event that we're going out to cover. Nobody wants to not cover it on the off chance that something big happens while their backs are turned. But you have to weigh that with, so if by covering it, are we making this event bigger than it really is?
Karen Grigsby Bates is a correspondent for our Code Switch team. Code Switch covers race and identity for NPR. Karen, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The press that has perfected image making to a science.
All right, an interview that ran on this program last Friday sparked a great deal of criticism. The interview was with Jason Kessler, an organizer of the white supremacist demonstrations in Charlottesville, Virginia, a year ago. He also planned yesterday's Unite the Right rally here in Washington, D.C. Many commentators criticized NPR, saying we gave Kessler a platform to broadcast hateful views. NPR put out a statement saying it stands by the airing of this interview. NPR's David Folkenflik put on his media critic's hat to take a look and a listen.
A couple dozen protesters, far outnumbered by counter-demonstrators, police, and reporters.
White people deserve to be able to stand up for their rights.
By almost any measure, Kessler's like protest in Washington yesterday was a dud. NPR's critics say the same of the Kessler interview. Some of those criticisms are hyperbolic, even unfair. Others raise uncomfortable questions about the era we're in and NPR's ability to meet the moment. Here's how Kessler presented himself.
I'm not a white supremacist. I'm not even a white nationalist. I consider myself a civil and human rights advocate focusing on the underrepresented Caucasian demographic.
Host Noel King conducted the interview.
In what ways are white people in America underrepresented?
The segment wrapped up a week-long series inspired by the Charlottesville protests, featuring the city's new black female mayor and the mother of Heather Heyer, an anti-racism protester killed that day. Kenya Young is executive producer of Morning Edition.
So much came out of Charlottesville. It was a moment for race in America. It was a moment for the president. Every time there is some kind of march on Washington, we as an organization try to go for the person who's organizing it. And I had to question, why would this one be different? Is it because we don't agree with their message, that we don't want to hear that message?
Many critics said NPR conferred credibility on Kessler by giving him a platform. My feeling, as somebody who tries to think hard about the media, is that almost no figure, no matter how heinous, should be off limits. Not Hitler, not Stalin, not Pol Pot. But you've got to be very, very clear about what you want to accomplish and how you'll achieve it. King did push back quite a fair amount.
Washington, how is the First Amendment under attack in your case? You've also invited a former Grand Wizard of the KKK, David Duke. You've invited a public neo-Nazi supporter. Why are these people invited to your rally? I'm citing the National Park Service, sir.
Yet there were some big omissions. Listeners did not hear King's questions about the killing in Charlottesville, what Kessler sees in President Trump, or the history of white racism. The interview was taped, cut back from nearly 70 minutes to under 7. For listeners, of course, what matters is what's broadcast. Some critics claim the Kessler interview reflected NPR's whiteness. In this case, that's just wrong. Noel King is biracial, Kenya Young is African-American, so is the NPR deputy managing editor who approved the interview. Yet, what insight do such interviews offer that a reported story could not? Further, can a news organization with a reputation for civility, striving for fairness and inclusion, constructively interview someone who rejects those values? On Twitter, King wrote, "Yes, there will be soul-searching, but this interview was done with intent, deliberation, and thought." My first professional experience was at the Daily Paper in Charleston, South Carolina. I covered two Klan marches, the point of which was to stir enough controversy to get coverage. I was an intern. The editor-in-chief stopped by my desk. "Cover what happens," he said, "but don't write long, don't get flowery. You don't want to give racists publicity for no good reason." So the Kessler interview? A tough call. For NPR News, I'm David Folkenflik.
And I think I speak for all of Black America when I say that we are all praying for Omarosa. I don't even know what she's doing in the news.
Former White House aide Omarosa Manigault Newman was forced to resign back in December. Now she's giving interviews to promote a new book. And in those interviews, she revealed that she secretly recorded her own firing. Now, that recording was played yesterday when she appeared on NBC's Meet the Press. NPR's White House correspondent Tamara Keith is with us now. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
President Trump tweeted this morning that Manigault Newman would, quote, "constantly miss meetings and work," end quote, and was vicious but not smart. The administration put out a statement last night criticizing her for, quote, "sneaking a recording device into the White House Situation Room." Was what she did illegal?
It's not clear that it would be. She was in there with John Kelly, the chief of staff, to be fired, or she would dispute that she was fired. She says she resigned under pressure. But they weren't talking about classified information. They were talking about HR information. The Situation Room is a series of conference rooms in the White House that are secure. You're supposed to leave your devices outside of the Situation Room. They're little cubbies to put electronics in. So this is pretty stunning that she recorded this and then that she is releasing this recording. The White House, in their statement from Sarah Sanders, says that it showed a blatant disregard for our national security. And then to brag about it on national television further proves the lack of character and integrity of this disgruntled former White House employee. That is from Sarah Sanders. She's not talking about the law there. And I would also just note that Manigault Newman was one of the highest paid people on the White House staff. She was a top level White House aide.
Manigault Newman is on this book tour, and she talked to our co-host Rachel Martin last week, and she said, look, I took elaborate notes and I made recordings because I worked in a toxic White House atmosphere. Now, here's some of that interview.
It is so incredibly important that you protect yourself. This is a president who lies without even thinking. People backstabbing one another, undermining one another. And so I have to tell you, I took great care to document every single exchange that I had.
I mean, Tam, this is really interesting because it is not an uncommon thing to hear about this administration. You have to watch your back because nobody else is.
Yeah, I mean, this is a White House that is full of warring factions. Some of that has quieted down, but you know, Omarosa Manigault Newman in her book writes about at one point being asked to put together a list of people who she thought were leakers and should be fired.
Wow.
I mean, this is it's an incredible environment. And the other thing to think about here is, you know, the White House is saying that she is sort of an unreliable narrator. This is a White House full of unreliable narrators with people leaking information sort of stab in the back someone else who is in a different faction. It's a remarkable thing to have watched.
And certainly sounds toxic, and it makes you wonder, I mean, how else has this manifested itself?
Well, there's a new recent Reuters analysis of staff payroll that found that 40% of the people who were on the payroll a year ago are no longer working at this White House. And,
wow.
And political scientists who study this say that that kind of turnover really hurts the effectiveness of a White House.
NPR's Tamara Keith. Thanks so much, Tam.
You're welcome.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
A former Brevard High School student convicted of racial intimidation wants to appeal the case and have a jury trial.
News 13's Kimberly King is live outside the Transylvania County Courthouse. Kim, jury selection was supposed to begin today.
Darcell, that's what the victim's mother understood, and that is why she came here to the Transylvania County Courthouse. She, along with the district attorney, want to see the previous conviction by a judge upheld. But now there is a chance that this case could be delayed once again.
I think if people don't speak out about this, then it'll continue to be shoveled under the rug.
Rosemary McNeil came to court this morning expecting a jury to be picked in a case involving her teenage son, a victim. Court records say that a former Brevard High School student threatened her son with a noose and used a racial epithet.
I'm hoping that all the evidence that was initially brought into the open court, that it's the same evidence that will be brought back into court to secure a second conviction in this appeal.
A judge has already found the Brevard graduate guilty. However, he has requested an appeal before a jury in Superior Court, which legally he can get.
It is in my greatest hopes that we can move on. It was in my greatest hopes with the first trial that we could move on, and that way my son can have the time that he needs to properly heal from this, which he has not.
The case was on the docket to be heard this week, but could get delayed again. The district attorney says because it's misdemeanor counts, felony cases take priority. DA Greg Newman in a statement saying, "We understand this is an important case to the black community, particularly in Brevard. We want to make sure that all our young people know any type of racially charged comments are harmful. And there was an assault here as well. They need to know that behavior won't be tolerated and that there are consequences." The DA says there is still a chance that this case could go before a jury this week, but he says the docket is full and that felonies take priority. The 17-year-old who was found guilty is now 18. He was allowed to graduate from Brevard High School, although he was transferred to an alternative school. We were not able to reach his attorney in this case for comment. Reporting live outside the Transylvania County Courthouse, Kimberly King, News 13.
Just now. I ain't no psychiatrist, ain't no doctor with degrees, but it don't take too much time to see what you're doing to me.
Otis Redding wrote the song and Aretha Franklin sang it. Respect, spell that R-E-S-P-E-C-T, was released in 1967 and quickly became an anthem for disenchanted lovers, bitter employees, and just about anyone who ever felt they'd been taken for granted. Respect is one of the NPR 100 most important American musical works of the 20th century. For commentator Evelyn C. White, Aretha Franklin's Respect was much more than just a catchy tune. It was a call to action.
I was a 13-year-old black girl growing up in the gritty steel town of Gary, Indiana. It was 1967, the height of the civil rights movement, with racial violence raging from coast to coast. A few years earlier, my tender psyche had been shattered by the bombing of the 16th Street Church in Birmingham, Alabama, which had left four little black girls dead. As I watched the haunting television images of the church's ruins, with its broken stained glass littering the streets, I wondered if racist whites would drop a bomb on me too. Then you came along and belted out Respect. Suddenly, my fears and vulnerabilities as a young black girl eased. For as much as I admired Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., I longed to see a black female face speaking out for our freedom, especially after the Birmingham bombing. There was Rosa Parks, Ella Baker, and Fannie Lou Hamer, but somehow their light had been subsumed by Dr. King and the other black men who'd become the drum majors for justice. With Respect, you gave black women an unprecedented voice and visibility. Your song spoke to the racism that needed to be vanquished in the country, and it addressed, in a way We Shall Overcome never did, the sexism that needed to be conquered in the black community. By the late 1960s, black women were demanding more from relationships than the unrealistic images portrayed in songs like My Girl and How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You. But there was no blissful fantasizing about love and Respect. You gave us raw energy and down-home truth. I remember feeling a sense of triumphant elation whenever I heard you let loose with those rollicking, sock it to me, soul licks. Here's a sister who ain't taking no mess, I think to myself joyfully. You made me feel good about myself, both as a black American during a tumultuous political era and as a young girl about to discover sex. So, now it's time to confess. 20 years ago, after a concert you gave at Radio City Music Hall in New York City, I was determined to meet you and to thank you for making me feel special. To get backstage, I told the security guard that I was Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, and it worked. I was immediately escorted to your dressing room. You greeted me graciously with a sisterly warmth, knowing full well, I'm sure, that I was an imposter. But you never let on. You maintain the stature and dignity befitting your justly earned title as the Queen of Soul. While I don't regret it, I would never engage in such tomfoolery today. And I want you to know that I meant no disrespect. On the contrary, when I cajoled myself backstage, I was trying to recapture the sense of pride and possibility you'd given me when I was 13 years old. I was swept up in pure emotion and motivated only by, well, that song you seared into the conscience of a nation. Ooh, your kisses, ooh, sweeter than honey, ooh, and guess what, ooh, so is my money, ooh, all I want you to do for me is give it to me when you get home.
Evelyn C. White is a writer and visiting scholar in women's studies at Mills College in Oakland, California.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. Suck it to me, 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 suck it to me
context of white supremacy. Aretha Franklin passed away at the age of 76 this week. I put in the description on social media, I think I'm going to amend it so it'll be the same at iTunes, Black Talk Radio Network, the other sites where the cows are archived, that she died at the young age of 76. I definitely want a more accurate, a more healthful frame of reference when we talk about health and life expectancy. I do not think, if there were a system of justice, I do not think you would have black people, particularly someone, black geniuses like Aretha Franklin dying at 76. That is appalling. Particularly with the resources that she had access to. I think if there were not a system of white supremacy, I think she could have been 76 in fantastic health, continuing to sing or do whatever else she wanted to do with her time and energy. I think that right there is the stress, the product of the system of white supremacy. But Aretha Franklin passing away this week at the age of 76. And I think today, Kofi Annan, former United Nations Secretary General, Kofi Annan, black male, I think that's a cowbell, unfortunately. But I think he passed away today also. Also, I believe at a relatively young age, what I would consider the stress of racism, white supremacy. Black health is important. Dr. Welsing would agree, I'm sure. This is the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, comments. Today's date, August 18th, 2018. So I have been told. If you have thoughts on any of the news segments that we heard, counter-racist suggestions, your own ideas or questions that you would like to submit, give us a call. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A few things before we get to the callers. Context of white supremacy. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. The address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, the PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and I will get you a physical mailing address. Enormous gratitude to all of the Cows listeners who have invested over the last decade. I am extraordinarily thankful and hope that this broadcast reflects your time and energy. I hope we are submitting constructive, accurate information on what white supremacy racism is and how it works. If you're not into PayPal, again, you can drop an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. And you can also, when you're on the blog, you can see the link for my Amazon wish list. It is under Gus T. Renegade. Again, extraordinary thanks to all the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list over the years. Again, I hope this broadcast has been worthy of your time and energy. Especially thanks to all the folks who have nabbed yoga items for Gus T. over the last 8 months now that I've been practicing. Much obliged. My practice has definitely appreciated it. A few other things to touch on before we get to some of the callers. The segment where they were talking about the opioid, so-called opioid epidemic. And they were talking with the suspected race soldier mother, addict, heroin junkie. And she's got her future race soldier suspect. And she says, you know, they gave her the medication so she could get through her withdrawal symptoms and all that and go on to raise another little racist brute, probably. And they say that everything now, she is the picture of health, blonde. And they go on to give the rest. But just that right there, the picture of health, not anything dark, not anyone with any melanin, not someone that looks like Aretha Franklin. The picture of health, blonde. Even a heroin junkie, picture of health. All we got to do is get it cleaned up a little bit. Still blonde, still classified as white. Picture of health. Next, I played that segment, the Sunday Puzzle from NPR. I listen to that regularly since I have been displaced with the flood. 8 months, almost 9 months, still displaced. No ETA as to when that could change. Anyway, but there have been a few things that I have tried to retain to just add some homeostasis, as they say, some balance. I try to listen to NPR on a daily basis to just get different bits of information sometimes to see how they're practicing racism within the segment. But I make an effort to listen to Sunday Puzzle. I don't know if people recall the grandsister, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, in the ISIS papers and on many programs. She has talked about the anagram in the term America. Anagrams, when you move the letters around in a word to form a new word or words. In America, you move the words around and you can get I am race. That's an anagram. They have whole games where you do that. Sunday Puzzle, my goodness. That is a news segment, okay? That segment airs once a week on Sundays. It's during weekend edition on Sunday mornings. And it's a news program. They're talking about, you know, what President Trump did this week and should we bomb North Korea and, you know, what is President Putin up to? And then they pause, time for the Sunday Puzzle. And then they get back to, you know, whatever else that they're talking to. But to have a weekly say, and that segment, I think, is years old. They've been doing that for decades, the weekly Sunday Puzzle. And I listen to it and I am amazed. Just listening sometimes, I feel so extraordinarily ignorant and unskilled with words, just baffled at the different types of games that they play with words and how it's designed to make you think in a different way. That segment that I played there was an especially astounding piece because I think I listened to it at least two or three times and I still was struggling to even understand what are you trying to even get the directions for the game in terms of you're making an anagram and then you're trying to get a cliche. Word masters. That is not just for fun. That is how you become more skilled with the use of words. Boggle, Scrabble, they have all those types of games. Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., when he talks about how race soldiers, they make their business and their fun one and the same, I think he says consistently the primary way that white supremacy is practiced is through the skillful use of words to deceive. Word masters, you have to constantly, constantly refine your tools. I submit that Sunday Puzzle segment is refining of the primary tool. Next, Gus T. Renegade, now officially victim of white supremacy, certified yoga instructor. As predicted before, Gus is able to move back to his regular residence, certified as a yoga instructor who has successfully completed the 200-hour yoga teacher training program. Great illustration of using Mr. Fuller's compensatory investment request. Again, all of this began with making that request live on air. White woman admitted racist, Anna Brown Griswold, that she pay for my teacher training, which is approximately $3,000, maybe 100 under that, but right at $3,000, that she pay the bill. Gus T was able to take the 8-week course, complete it. I have my certification. I can register officially for a few nickels, and whites, race soldiers will be able to look online and say this nigger here is officially registered as a yoga instructor. I am looking forward to being able to teach black people exclusively yoga. I could probably tolerate non-white people, but I would really like to share the practice with Black people. I have greatly appreciated the many, many listeners around the world, even who've written in since I've been talking about my own yoga practice and experiences, who have started practicing themselves and have seen, you know, great development with their own body or just feeling better or losing a little bit of weight, whatever it is that has really inspired Gus T. And I am looking for opportunities to teach. No coincidences. Today, I saw a suspected racist wearing a shirt, Yoga Behind Bars, which I'd heard about that program before. And I thought, oh, wow, here in Washington State, Seattle specifically, they cage a lot of Negros. I would be willing to do that program. I'd probably get access to teaching a lot of Black people. I'm going to check into that. Also, one of the ways that they informed us in teacher training that you could market yourself, in addition to teaching in a studio or wherever else, prison, doing yoga retreats. Whites do a lot of those. I thought, wow, Gus T doing a counter-racism yoga retreat. I would be ecstatic to host such an event. Get to maybe have two yoga classes per day. I think that's generally what's done at retreats, and then do a different segment about racism, make that more meditation. But I was giddy just thinking about it, and I am someone who is not giddy often, but counter-racist yoga retreat. Could even be camping. Easy to do out here in the great Seattle area. Could be someplace else, but I'm definitely thinking I would be very interested in leading such an endeavor. If folks have thoughts, let me know. I've never gone on a yoga retreat, so I'm not really sure what they look like. That's something I was thinking about as well. I was also thinking, we are slowly encroaching on the 10-year anniversary of the cows. Doing a yoga retreat to celebrate the 10-year anniversary, I would definitely sign up for that. Have to think more on it, but still in the initial moments of the certification. Coincidentally, there's a lot that I could say, a lot more that I could say about what happened just the last 2 days of yoga teacher training. That was, wow, counter-racism, minute by minute, and that is being very literal. I talked about some of this on Thursday's Neutralizing Workplace Racism, that segment, but I did not go into a lot of details. I can really only emphasize that any setting that you're in, if it's a classroom setting, a work setting, any setting where there are rules that are supposed to be followed, where you are with a group and everybody that's a part of the group, there's some sort of contract in terms of what we are supposed to do, services that are supposed to be provided or how we're supposed to conduct ourselves, whatever it is, really be someone who is informed about the rules and make it be even getting a reputation for being someone who is about abiding by the rules, being informed about the rules, being clear about what the rules and expectations are, and then are we abiding by those rules? Everybody, not going around necessarily nitpicking to see who's late and when they're, you know, arriving and such, although that might, you know, be important, but really just being mindful about important rules, them being enforced and being enforced consistently. And report, as it was said, Omarosa, the great Omarosa Manigault Newman, say the full name, documentation. I think that gets mentioned on workplace racism, documenting and just the importance of words. Gus T is not a word master, but I am able to use a word now and then in a constructive manner. And just writing to, sometimes you have to write to the more powerful whites who can solve the problem. I would say have no hesitation at all in contacting the most powerful white person. If that's the CEO, whomever it is, contact them. If that's multiple whites, do that. But just Gus T doing that alone, I ended up, I'm trying to be brief so that we can get to the callers, but just contacting them to report, I didn't even report that they were practicing racism. It was just they were not being professional. If we say that these are the expectations, we ask specifically, and then you come back and contradict that at the next class consistently, what are we doing here? We're wasting time, we're not organized, and we're not professional. Just that alone, and providing evidence clearly, concisely, the more powerful whites in charge of the yoga studio, not only did they contact Gus T and ask, "What did I want?" giving many options for handling the situation and acknowledging that they were wrong and that the training was not conducted in a competent manner in alliance with how they want teacher trainings to be conducted. I was able to get out of adjustments totally. I've talked about not wanting to touch in the spirit of Bill Cosby, not wanting to do any adjustments. I said, I am not giving or receiving any adjustments for my final exam, and that should not count against my grading. The white woman I was talking to agreed immediately and said she would contact the instructors so that they would know that before I even arrived at class, and that that would be a non-issue, and it was. The other students were told, regardless of if they had all of the requirements completed or not, they would not be getting their teacher certificate until Sunday. I got my teacher certificate on Friday, was able to leave class an hour early, and was excused from the Sunday class where they will have to go, and maybe they get their certificate if they have completed all the requirements. I don't have to attend that at all. And I have frequently suggested that victims of racism in certain situations on the job and elsewhere, you request, can I have additional time to think? That's what I invoked on Friday when speaking with the corporate representative. She said, yes, you can call me on Monday. And in her words, tell me what we can do to make you whole. So I will have an opportunity to request some form of compensation. My friends have requested that I request, since I already have my teacher training certificate, that I request a full refund of the $3,000, since I was not satisfied and they agree that the training was not done in an appropriate manner. And this is a huge studio. They have more than 100 different facilities across the so-called country, that I should request a full refund. He thinks that that's something that they could and probably would be willing to do, since they've admitted that they were incorrect. I felt, and this could just be, I'm a victim of white supremacy. I've been niggerized. I felt the only word I can come up with now is some sense of, I guess, guilt. If I think of a better word, I'll substitute, but guilt, like, oh, is that unreasonable? Am I asking too much? And they said, no, you're just being a victim. Whites do this sort of thing all the time and more. Ask for a full refund. That would be that would be a sizable win for Gus T, something to celebrate, to be able to get, and then to get the race soldier who paid for it to make sure that those funds are transferred to me so that you get the full $3,000. That would be extraordinary. And even if they bargain down and only do half, that would still be a great counter-racist, small victory for Gus T. But I will report back to how that goes. But I have certificate in hand. I am a little paranoid about it. I checked to see if it was going to disintegrate or if somehow they had not put the appropriate stamp or number or something that I would need on it. But it seems to be official, authentic, certified, done with teacher training. I'm so thankful to have my time back. It took 200 hours, literally means 200 hours, but victim of white supremacy, certified yoga instructor, and looking forward to counter racism yoga retreat. If folks have ideas and thoughts on putting that together and making that happen, you can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Lastly, I spoke with, his name has been mentioned so many times this evening, Neely Fuller Jr., producejustice.com. I called him on Tuesday. I'm trying to think. Oh, I called him. The book that we paused because of my yoga 5-hour teaching exam, I called him to ask about the buyer always being to blame. We're talking about the transaction of selling slaves. And he'd said before that the buyer is always to blame. So I called him to ask him about the logic of that. And he, when I was speaking with him, he had refined it to say that the person who is most to blame is the person who has the most power, the most control, the person who is most in charge of the interaction. Doesn't matter if they're the buyer or the seller, the person who has the most power, that would be racist man, racist woman in our situation. Anyway, as the conversation was evolving, he was making an illustration, and he said, as you called me, I was reading the paper. Reading more important than watching television. I say that consistently. Mr. Fuller reads the newspaper. Dr. Welsing, she read the newspaper. Dick Gregory read the newspaper. Many of these folks, they did not subscribe to the nonsense of, oh, it's all lies, I'm not going to read that. That's folk. No, they did not take that position. They tried to read to see what was being printed, what was being said, to be informed. So he said, I was reading the newspaper about a horse. And I said, oh, really? He said, yes, I was reading about this horse, and the horse was named Shadow. They changed the horse's name to Justice. Now, as he was talking, if folks have not heard Mr. Fuller, or really if you get to talk to him personally, he is quite a character. I laughed as he was explaining until my stomach hurt. So he says, I'm not making this up. You can read it. You're on the computer. You do that sort of thing. Punch it up on the computer and get the article. I do so. It was in the Washington Post, his part of the world. The article, and it has lots of pictures. I don't know what the physical paper looks like, but if you look online, it has lots of pictures. Seeking justice for Justice the horse. Can a neglected animal sue? Now, this is a lengthy report. I'm not going to read the full article. But a few portions that I did think were important. It's written by Karen Brulard from August 13th. Justice is an 8-year-old American quarter horse who used to be named Shadow. And when he was named Shadow, he suffered at a veterinarian's exam last year. Or wait a minute. And when he was named Shadow, he suffered. At a veterinarian's exam last year, he was 300 pounds underweight. His black coat lice ridden, his skin scabbed, and his genitals so frostbitten that they might still require amputation. The horse had been left outside and underfed by its previous owner, who last summer pleaded guilty to criminal neglect, and now Justice, who today resides with other rescued equines on a quiet wooded farm within view of Oregon's Cascade Mountains, Justice is suing his former owner for negligence. In a lawsuit filed in his new name in a county court, the horse seeks at least $100,000 for veterinary care as well as damages for pain and suffering to find a trust that would stay with him no matter who is his caretaker. Now, I'm not going to read, as I said, again, the entire report. Skipping down just a little bit in the report. And again, they have lots of pictures of Justice, so you can see this black beast and the suffering. And then they even have a couple of pictures where there's a white horse around, and you can see Justice as well. Anyway, so it says, according to court findings, Justice's former owner, Gwendolyn Vircher, surrendered the horse to a rescue organization in March 2017 at the urging of a neighbor in Cornelius, west of Portland, right down the road from Gus T. In a letter to law enforcement, an equine veterinarian who examined the horse at the time said he was severely emaciated, lethargic, and weak. That the poor condition probably contributed to a lasting problem. The animal's penis had prolapsed, and his inability to retract it led to frostbite, trauma, and infection. When I got him, he was a lot worse than I anticipated, said Kim Moseman, executive director of Sound Equine Options, which takes in and finds homes for about 100 horses each year. Justice, whom Moseman finally describes as like a grumpy old man, has gained weight and become more social. On a sun-soaked afternoon at the dusty farm in Escotada, he nibbed grass along a retired racehorse named Flick and used his nose to nudge the notebook of a visiting reporter. But the lawsuit says his penis may require partial amputation and that his medical conditions will demand long-term care. Now, I spoke to Mr. Fuller about this in between hysterical laughter, and he emphasized, word masters. No one cared about this horse when the name was Shadow. Beat it. Stick it outside. Let it freeze to death. Starve him to death. Let his penis fall off. No one cared. Changed his name to Justice. Whoa. Supreme Court case. They can shoot your child in the street, leave him out there for 5 hours. You're not going to the Supreme Court. Justice the horse. Supreme Court case. Might even get $100,000. And if I was the wager, I would say that this horse is going to get that $100,000. Or whomever is representing the horse's trust, they're going to get that $100,000 and maybe a lot more. And they go on to talk about how this may extend to dogs and word masters. That was one. Also doing this, I asked Mr. Fuller, I said, well, hey, maybe black people should do the same thing. Maybe black people should say, hey, as long as we use the name black, that's just what they're going to do to us. Have us outside, freezing, whole nine. Or all of that. Perhaps we should stop using the term black. Retire shadow, retire black. And he said, no. And I included in that, retire white as well. Let's not call individuals classified as white. Let's not do that anymore. How about that? Maybe it'll have the same impact. Worked so well for Justice the horse. And he said, no. I said, why? His response was, whites have bragged about exactly that. We're white. All of their nigger jokes. They've bragged about we're white all over the world. You're black. You're dumb, ignorant, shadow, spook, nigger, all of that. They've bragged about this for years. Now they're trying to pretend and act like that's not the case and move, at least publicly, not engage in that behavior. And his response was no. Confusion is lethal. Confusion is rampant about what racism, white supremacy is and how it works. That makes it very direct what this is, system of racism, white supremacy, using the very labels that they created and bragged about in constructing their system. Very logical in my view. Anywho, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. For this broadcast specifically, if we could not use metaphors, that would be extremely appreciated. Words are very important. Raise a picture of health. I said that previously. They are great at using metaphors, similes, making comparisons so that they can contrast two separate entities and insist that these are equivalent, identical. Often they are not. There are a myriad of ways that they use their skill with words to practice deception, white supremacy. Victims of white supremacy, Gusty included, we've been exposed to this behavior, and many of us, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't have logic to address certain subject matters, so we will substitute a metaphor, comparison of some sort, and often that does not accurately convey our thoughts. It just produces more confusion. If we could be direct, explicit about what it is that we want to say, that would be extremely appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. We do not talk about movies on the compensatory call-in. Make sure that I emphasize that we do not ever on this broadcast talk about what you saw at the movie theater. But this program specifically, we do not talk about movies. Can invest a lot of time in that, and that's not what this broadcast is for. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, if you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, that way everyone gets at least one chance to speak. If you have additional comments, if you could just wait until everyone has spoken once, and then you can share your question or thought or whatever you have. Also, if you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could please use your mute button, that way we don't have a lot of unnecessary noise to speak over. Just helps to preserve the audio quality of the broadcast. If you need to say something else, you can unmute yourself, say whatever you need to, and then mute your line. And then once everyone is done talking, or if you have another question, you can unmute and come back on and speak with us. Thank you for your cooperation. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Rob, in Wisconsin.
Greetings to Gus, the callers and the listeners. Very quickly, I've been living with my cousin since the last time we spoke, and out of an emergency situation, I will be leaving Milwaukee. I'll be moving to San Diego, California on the 21st of this month. I'll be staying with I'll be staying in a hotel room, and between the hotel room and with a friend, I feel a lot of anxiety about it. I feel excitement as well. I know that I'm moving into a more expensive environment, but I also feel that the change will be what is needed for my life right now. And I just wanted to share that bit of information, and I wanted to thank Ivy for reaching out. I did receive the email. I was just not in a place where I could respond to the email, and I thank you for taking the call.
Much obliged, Rob. I know that's some anxiety, and that's, you know, more than 1,000 miles from where you are to be moved that far, but that is spectacular. I cannot think of any circumstance where being relocated from Milwaukee, Wisconsin to San Diego, California is a bad thing. I have been to Wisconsin. I've been to San Diego specifically, and I love San Diego. I love California in general. Well, I will not even use the word love, although that is not a metaphor. I am very much pleased with the experience that I had in California, San Diego specifically, and I think that might be a constructive change of venue.
Last thing to add, the plane ticket was only $80. Thank you.
Grand. With that, other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, or at least the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. I wish Rob well. Instructor Gus. Gus the Renegade Instructor now. I'm proud of you. I wish you the best with that. As far as what you just spoke about, I totally disagree with Nellie Fuller on not using black, white, and I also disagree with him about replacing a system of white supremacy with a system of justice. In fact, that horse story sounds exactly what white justice would look like. You know, you get traumatized as a black person, and they pay you, get some money. And then at the end of the day, you're not able to have sex anyway. I guarantee white people would take that deal anytime. Rest in peace to Aretha. In my 41 years, I saw a lot of legends. Every artist die. Artisans of music who are considered as black. Aretha, Biggie, Tupac, James Brown, Michael Jackson, Prince, Whitney, Luther, just to name a few. All died before their time. All died due to white supremacy. And at her young age, with all the money that she should have accumulated, she wasn't supposed to die at that age. So-called white people, a.k.a. the people who classify themselves as white, meaning good and pure, as well as classify as black. Historically, they have been practitioners of sexual debauchery and sexual debaucherous behavior, and have shown a frequent tendency to be sexual degenerates, pedophiles, and rapists. So I saw an article this week that said that Paris is installing open-air urinals. So around the city of lights, they said she had blonde hair and bright eyes. So this is the city of lights. So this is white. They include the tourist areas and also the historical areas. The designer calls this the Eurotour. In France, I don't know how to say it. It's a combination of the French words urinal and pavement. And it serves an echo solution for peeing in public. Given the history of white people, white men in particular, for them to have the excuse to pull out their public penis in public, I say they have the potential to lead to sexual debauchery on all-time levels. And I wouldn't be going to France just because of this. And if anyone wants to go to France, just go to Vegas. You can see France there. Speaking of Vegas, I was on the Strip. Outside of an arena or a stadium or an amusement park, there's no place other than the Vegas Strip where you can pay. You have to pay $5 for a bottle of water. I saw these two young brothers who they had these two super huge coolers, and they were selling waters for $1 on the Strip. They were right under the undercourse that connects, partially connects the MGM Mirage to the Sands Venetian. And an hour later, I went back outside and I saw the police with one of the brothers in handcuffs. He was, so I went closer, and he was being put in the back of the police car. A crowd was around watching, mostly white people, of course. The other cop told the other guy with him to turn around, walk away, and don't look back. And as he was saying that, he opened the coolers, the man turned around and started walking away, and he allowed all those white people to grab free water. And I said, Vegas is a symbol of white supremacy. There's no greater symbol of white supremacy than a black man in handcuffs. They love that. The brother who got the roll cover, I hate when I hear the first black person or the first African-American. That, to me, forced his white validation. I heard the Still on the Move clip. It reminded me of Sioux Africa. The system runs off of logic, and it requires maintenance. The largest maintainers, you could call them the custodians or the janitors of the system, is the media, which is 100% controlled by the so-called white people who classify themselves as Jews. Lastly, Omarosa. During the election, I said we reached unprecedented territories that defy white code, because white people were calling Donald Trump a racist and a white supremacist, and that's something that I had never seen before. However, they've gotten back in cold with this, because I have not seen one black person who went into the media and called him a racist or white supremacy leave unscathed yet. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Other folks that we missed completely. I also, every time I hear anything associated with the MOVE organization now, I think, sadly, I think of Sioux Africa. Suspected race soldier. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is a victim out of New Jersey. First thing, Omarosa. A lot of people have been asking me about it in my circle. I give no opinion of her. I just hope out of all of this, with the information that she reveals, victims will be introduced into a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, if that's possible. That's the only thing I can hope that comes out of that situation. The au pair or the nannies, I work in New York City, so I see a lot of non-white women pushing white babies. That always clicked in my, put an idea in my mind and also confirmed of the system of white supremacy, because I've yet to see a white woman pushing a black baby. That's evidence of the unbalanced roles between blacks and whites in this country and the world. The media giving white supremacists a platform. If I'm not mistaken, someone said no figure should be off limits, not even Hitler. That said, while Netflix has basically is not allowing a a program about Louis Farrakhan to be aired on their platform. And also, and they say this at the same time when I'm in the archives and I'm reading about Ben Tillman, and I'm not sure if his statue is still up or if any of those buildings on Clemson or the other college, if those names have been changed. I've been in the archives listening to Ben Tillman autobiography, and wow, I mean, listening to that audio and looking at Donald Trump in real time, the parallels are just, I mean, if anybody is new to the cows, I would suggest you go to the archives and listen to the audio read of white supremacist, ex-senator, ex-governor of South Carolina, Ben Tillman. I mean, it was just amazing. Also, before I go, I do have a request. Being though that I did listen to the audio of Ben Tillman, there's a gentleman by the name of Willie Basket. The book is called All of God's Children. And who this man is, he gained notoriety because his numerous crimes he committed while he was still a minor led to the change in New York state law so juveniles at the age of 13 to be tried as an adult. The author of his book traced his lineage from his father to his grandfather, who also had a violent past. And they traced his lineage all the way to no other than Bill Tillman and Strom Thurmond's home state and county of Edgefield. So it was real interesting to listen to the audio and also read the book, All God's Children, about Willie Basket. That's all I have right now.
Much obliged, Strom Thurmond. Strom Thurmond. That is, I can't say it's top 10, although maybe it should be. It was a very important, constructive read. Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy. It's got one of my favorite quotes in it from all time, but I'm too lazy to pull up my notes. But it's if you scratch beneath the surface of a white person, there's a savage lurking beneath. That's a direct quote from the former governor of South Carolina. He was going to be a candidate for the United States president, founder, co-founder of Clemson University, South Carolina legend, and they did not remove any of his statues or any of the buildings that are named after him in the great state of South Carolina, even after Dylan Storm Roof's terrorist attack. But and we were reading that book. We read it right after Dylan Storm Roof's terrorist attack and right before, well, he wasn't president at the time, but soon to be President Donald J. Trump, when it was still, what? Oh, that's crazy. It's no way he's going to be the only person at the time who was saying, oh, yeah, next president was the grandcester. All God's Children. Someone else recommended that. We might. Barracoon is this Friday. All done. This coming Friday out of here. But All God's Children has been recommended before. We will take that under serious consideration. Other folks who dialed in with the hand up line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada. Oh, whoops, sorry, that was not Red. Sorry. Yes, ma'am, we can hear you.
Greetings, Gus, callers and listeners. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I first wanted to say Victoria, the lady that was addicted to heroin and was able to stay and care for her baby beyond in the hospital and beyond. Before I heard the end of the clip, I thought to myself, she has to be a white woman because they don't have that type of compassion for us in that way at all. And for the reporter to mention that they're still unsure about the long-term effects of treating these babies is just very saddening and shows their overall lack of concern or care for these children, even their own children. the 40-year anniversary of the attack on the MOVE members, which I still have yet to find any articles or any material, any news media to report this or label it as a domestic attack. So we know they will never call it what it is, but we all know that was definitely a domestic attack on the MOVE members. Also, one of the clips mentioned Kessler organizing the protest in Charlottesville. I would argue to say that he may be the face, but they failed to mention that the real organization behind the Charlottesville protest, as well as the Las Vegas shooting and some of these other events that they have had, was a organization by the name of Crowds on Demand, who hire people, hire and pay these people very well, mind you, to show up and be actors for these protests and these different rallies that we're seeing in the news media every single day. I also saw a clip this week of a doctor in Colorado yelling at police officers as he was being arrested and restrained. And he was saying, "Stop treating me like an effing black person." Let that sink in. Let that resonate for a moment. Stop treating me like an effing black person. And I thought to myself, here is this racist, still alive, still breathing, unscathed, tased, or sprayed, yet here he is wondering why his white privilege is not protecting him from being treated like a black person. Interesting. A couple of questions regarding that clip. I wanted to see if anyone has seen a longer video. I wondered if he eventually got sprayed because he was continuously resisting. I also wondered if he realized the fact that he actually, that the fact that him getting a warning about being sprayed is essentially his white privilege at work, because we don't get that. We don't get any warnings when they're going to attack us in any way. If any of the callers or you, Gus, remember the video from a couple of weeks ago when the handcuffed man got tased with no warning, to give an example. They never give us any example. So for him to think that he was being treated like a black person and his white privilege wasn't allowing him to not be treated in such a way was just fascinating. Also,
before you proceed, I tried to wait. I'm going to let you finish, but just on this broadcast, I do request that we not use the term white privilege. I am not talking about quote unquote white privilege. I am talking about the system of white supremacy, white power. In my view, that term is extraordinarily incorrect. It promotes confusion in a myriad of ways, more than I can discuss at this current moment. It's definitely in the archives in large volume, but I do request that people not use that term on the program, and used it three times. I was willing to wait a few, but I don't think I could take a fourth. So if we could not use that term, I would be happier slightly on the plantation. Much obliged.
Absolutely. We can definitely exchange that for white power, because it would definitely serve as equally well. Also, we lost another great one, rest in power, Aretha. But listening to one of the last clips that you played, talking about Aretha, one of the reporter mentioned women demanding more from relationships back in the 60s. And when I heard that, I wondered if this was one of the things that white women saw and used to get us to join the feminist movement, if this was one of their earliest entryways, I guess, to get us to join that particular movement. And thanks for taking my call, Gus, and congrats to Rob on his relocation.
Oh, much obliged, much obliged. And yes, congratulations. Exiting Wisconsin for California, much better plantation. Go to the beach, my goodness. Let's see, other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, this time, Red in Las Vegas.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello to everyone, and always appreciate Thomas's commentary about Las Vegas. I don't actually go to the Strip.
I actually avoid it, even if I have to cross over it. I hate it. But it makes me think about how I've seen different people who may or may not be classified as white who speak Spanish. They sell fruit on the side of the road. I'm not sure if I've seen like any exchanges between them and race soldiers, but I just definitely thought that that was interesting. And then not only that, to, you know, give away the black male's water, you know, that's really terrible. And the fact that at the grocery stores, you can get either 24 or 32 pack of water for like $2 most of the time, and how they sell it for $5, it doesn't surprise me at all. The other thing that I wanted to, the comments that I had about the clips, the first one, the Vogue clip, and the thing that really got my attention was the fact that the black male, he said that when he got the call for doing the magazine cover, he said that he was living his whole life for that one phone call, and just how, you know, sad that it was, that is, actually. And then, you know, just reflecting on myself, making sure that I constantly keep checking whatever subliminal white validation that I may still have in me, and that just, you know, always, you know, not trying to degrade another victim who may be confused, because I could be, you know, looked at as being confused to other victims. So, you know, definitely still learning. Of course, the drug addict, white racist, having a baby and not having it taken away. And I know I spoke about this before on the show, how like back in Ohio, I have, because I don't have any children, but how like black females around me had said that I cannot remember. I feel like at least with one instance, there was a black female that I was told by like family members that her baby was taken away because they found weed in the baby system because she smoked weed during pregnancy. And I don't, you know, condone that or anything like that, but it seems like, you know, if some people are saying that weed is medicinal and then other people are saying, you know, it's a drug, you'll take away the black female's babies. But this white drug addict, you know, when she's actually doing very, you know, hard drugs that can kill an adult, no, she needs to have her baby. She needs to have her little racist urchin, you know, still within her presence. So definitely thought that that was interesting, to say the least. And then the fact that, you know, doctors would give babies morphine, you know, I'm like, I'm surprised that whites haven't came up with a better solution to even treat their drug addicted opioid babies, as they should rightfully be called. The other thing that I wanted to mention, there was an article in the Las Vegas Sun, and it was about, I thought it was interesting. And again, I don't know if these people are considered non-white or white, but the title was Nevada Democrats Hope Latinos Will Propel Them to Victory. And just within the article, just basically kind of, it seems like it's similar to how Democrats, i.e. white people, use black people. But I guess, you know, in this state, they don't actually, you know, there's not enough black people to use. So they use the quote unquote Latinos, and just talking about how, you know, their other quote unquote Latinos are outside of the Latino supermarkets and stuff like that, trying to get other people to sign up. There's also some quote unquote Latinos talking about how, you know, they would like Trump. And actually one person said, I'm Latino, I would never vote for Trump, but I think that a lot of things Trump is doing is right, but he's a racist guy. Didn't really elaborate, but, you know, I just thought that that was interesting. And the last thing was in the Las Vegas Review Journal, they had an article entitled Nebraska Uses Opioid Fentanyl in Inmate Execution. And just reading over the article, all it basically talks about is how this white man killed two other white men and how they were putting him to death. But I wanted to find out, why are they using this drug that there's so many of them are dying from, on killing, you know, an inmate? And of course, the article didn't give any details about that. But I thought it was interesting trying to find out. Now they're kind of, it's kind of odd to me. And of course, I'm, you know, still learning. you know, why they didn't even provide, okay, this is why we're using this drug. They said that, you know, they use Valium and other things, but they didn't specifically say why they're now using or they use fentanyl. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Interesting. Experimenting, perhaps. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Let's see. Wow, folks.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was getting my little timer ready. Thank you for taking my call. Congratulations on your certification. Hopefully you'll be able to, you know, parlay that into some, well, not parlay, but, you know, work that into extra income. If you want to do, if you want to have it at a, usually those things are on that, occur at hotels and stuff, and found a website that with some black-owned hotels, and the closest one to you right now is in Oregon. That's on this website. There could be little ones I don't know about, but according to this website, the closest one would be, there's one in Hillsborough, I don't know where that is, and Portland. So those are the closest ones to you right now, just to, you know, get you thinking about that if that's something you're really interested in. Again, lots of good, interesting clips. Hello?
Oh, I think that was just background. Sorry about that.
Okay. So very interesting clips. I found out more about Aretha Franklin this week than ever in my whole life. And she wrote a book, and that's my own fault. And I guess trying to find out more about her, I guess I just never thought about it that much. But I hope her funeral is not taken over by white people like Muhammad Ali's funeral. That would be total disgust. Because she seemed like one of the few people that black people and white people liked about the same amount. I didn't see any, they didn't, well, from what I saw on the coverage, you know, they didn't really talk about any controversy in her career and things like that, from what I saw. So I know that Lady Carole King wrote Natural Woman. She does not have to show up at the funeral to sing it. No, Miss King, do I show up. And congratulations to Bob for being able to move to a different area. Different areas always give you different perspectives. So I'm happy for you, excited for you. I hope it all works out. You know, continue to let us know and see if we can help you in any way we can. And I know you said you talked to Mr. Fuller about not calling black people black people. I think that's what they do in Portugal and the Portuguese countries, because I think you had a clip on that a long time ago, and how the people from Cape Verde, they consider Portuguese, but they're the black people, and they were suffering discrimination as well. So I don't know if taking that label away will help. And also, there was this lady, it was announced on C-SPAN, which has a lot of book reviews, and a lot of people are writing about race. I'm not promoting watching TV, but that C-SPAN, they have lots of little interviews with authors. There was a lady, she wrote a book, a black lady, from the picture she appears to be a black lady. Her name was Cheryl Cashin. And she wrote a book, her latest book, called Loving, you know, that couple. Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. I almost laughed because I was like, I don't know what threat that is. But she also wrote three other books, Place Not Race, The Agitator's Daughter, I think that's about her family and their activism, and then it says The Failure of Integration. So I don't know, she might be an interesting guest. Because it seems like Loving is a successful integration for them and not for us. But I guess I'll have to, I just found out about her. And she's going to be, I think, on, they have some special Sunday interview show. And they're going to be talking about the Loving book. That's why it came up. That's C-SPAN. They have a lot of books. I mean, if you went there, you can get authors probably forever. And not even have to ask us. Because they talk about race all the time. Thank you. That's all.
Much obliged. I am a fan of C-SPAN. I should probably watch more because, as you said, they do tend to have a lot of
material that's dealing directly with white supremacy, racism, although I'm not familiar with that. The author that you mentioned in the Loving book, is the Loving book like her, is that like her most recent work? Is that what like she's promoting right now?
Yes, but I believe it was written last year. But like I said, tomorrow, I believe it's tomorrow because I was listening this week while I was doing other things. I believe tomorrow they have like a special literary show in the evening. And I believe last week, like D.L. Hughley was on it, which I was like, okay, whatever. No, that's the handbook. When this, I think the title and how the interracial intimacy and the threat to white supremacy, of course, you know, listened to the show for a few years now, that kind of, you know, I became more alert. I was like, oh, I might have to make sure I watch that because I want to see what she has to say.
I'm going to make a note to watch that myself. I will.
And according to Amazon, you know, they have a little blurb about her. She's a law professor at Georgetown University. So.
How interesting. I will. When I can, I'll find the links. Book TV, they're normally pretty good about links and what have you.
Yeah, that's what it is. Book TV, I guess.
They normally are pretty good about links and such. So once I'm able to track it down or locate it, I'll
I can look for it. I can look for it while we're talking and email it to you. That's no big deal.
Awesome. I will share with listeners. Thank you kindly, ma'am.
Consider it a graduation present. Woo-hoo.
Wow. All right, then. Yes, thank you for the graduation present. Reading is more important than watching television, Dr. Welsing. Other folks that we missed completely, if you have a hand up, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in, if you could use your mute button if you're not speaking, just to make sure, or if you know you're in a noisy environment, just to make sure we don't have any unnecessary noise. Other folks who dialed in that we missed completely, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi there. This is my first time calling the compensatory call-in, so just a little nervous. Congratulations to you, Gus. I know you've gotten a lot of congratulations tonight. I was interested in talking about Omarosa. There was a specific interview with the Today Show that has kind of gone viral, and I think it was really impressive just to kind of see her counter-racist codification. She really seemed, she dominated that interview. And I'm currently with child, and I actually had a white woman offer to do my baby shower last week, and just some of the dynamics of how she treated me, even though she was, you know, really adamant about hosting this particular baby shower, it was just quite interesting. And to see kind of the response white women are giving to Omarosa as she's like going on this campaign against Trump, and just how her intelligence, it just kind of really struck me as fascinating in their refinement, and yet they're, you know, just kind of hard to conceal hatred for Black women specifically. It's just something that I just wanted to point out. So again, I don't know if you've talked about this specifically, but the Today Show interview, it's pretty much gone viral, but it was really fascinating to watch this woman kind of dominate that conversation, even though she was treated quite hostilely by the, I think the host, Savannah, something. But that was all the input I wanted to add.
I didn't see the Today Show interview, but what specifically I'm saying there just seems to be something like the pattern. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, I was speaking to her, and I think she might have mentioned it on the program things when I would talk to her privately that I thought were really significant. If I hadn't heard her address them before, I would try and bring them up on the air. I think she might have mentioned this on the air too, but I remember back when I know she won at least 5 Coon of the Month awards. Melissa Harris Perry, she had her program on MSNBC, not Coon of the Month awards from me. That, you know, is not something I advocate anyway. Melissa Harris Perry, Dr. Welsing would watch her program, and she said that she thought it was very significant and racist that her program on MSNBC, they would have her first name in all capital letters. With other people, it would be their last name, like Rachel Maddow, it's Maddow that's up there. They don't just refer to people on a first name basis. And she said that's just standard in terms of talking to black people, quote unquote adult or quote unquote grown black people, and just calling them on a first name basis. They used to do that even when it was President Obama. It would be Barack by something, that sort of thing. So I try to at least say her whole name. That's just my personal code, even though, I mean, Omarosa Manigault Newman, like, wow, that's a lot. But it seems something incorrect about referring to this black female on a first name basis. But what do you think she did to dominate the Today Show interview?
Wow. I would highly recommend that you watch this interview. From the onset, the interviewer, Savannah, she was having a very hard time keeping her composure. Omarosa is kind of a mastermind of staying calm during interviews, which is something that I know that you recommend quite a bit. And so what she would do is fire off questions extremely fast. And it got to a point where even as an audience member, like, you're like, okay, why is this woman so hostile? Why is she trying to catch Omarosa up? Omarosa kind of paused and said, it's okay. You don't have to ask me 10 questions at, you know, one point. It's okay, Savannah. And so she kind of paced the interview and towards the end kind of called her out and said, okay, well, we've gone over time. You know, we're now at 10 minutes. You know that this is a 7-minute interview. So she basically kind of made the interviewer, who was quite hostile, and, you know, and if you watch the interview, you'll see for yourself, already had some type of antagonism towards Omarosa. She made on her own show her look very amateur. And I've just never seen, somebody do that on a, you know, television interview, let alone a black woman. And so if you look at other TV commentators, I think Megan, she used to be on Fox, but she now has her own TV show. You know, they're trying to side with the Savannah Guthrie lady, and other, like, white people are really trying to cover for Savannah, even though it's obvious to most Americans that, If you look at other commentaries and whatnot, that it was Savannah who was quite rude to Omarosa. And so just as a black woman having to deal with white women and their refinement, it was so refreshing and yet, like, amazing to watch. So I'd highly just recommend that you would watch that, Gus, if you haven't.
Duly noted. I will put that on the top of my watch list. And it from what I've heard, some of that sounds very similar to what I think makes just excellent counter-racist logic sense in terms of how you want to function if you're talking to or being questioned by a white person, in keeping your composure, managing your emotions. We talk about that on workplace racism all the time. Stopping. It is perfectly okay to pause. They will try to ask you a lot of questions and to get you to talk very, very fast so that you're speaking without thinking and really carefully choosing your words and thinking about what you want to say. Extraordinary counter-racist techniques. And what I said at the beginning of the program, just really making sure that whites honor their agreement. Like, if we said this is supposed to be a 7-minute interview, why are you still grilling me at the 10-minute mark? Like, what is going on? Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Absolutely. Brilliant. And that's the same way.
It was brilliant, Gus. It was brilliant. And like I said, I'm not a fan of her. Most people aren't. But you can really learn some techniques from that lady. She's very sharp. I don't think she gets enough credit for that, but she's quite sharp. She went to Dr. Welsing's alma mater, Howard. And so I think there's something to be said about that as well.
Interesting. Where Dr. Welsing was denied tenure, but system of white supremacy. Fascinating. I'm sure some other folks saw the Today Show interview, so they can offer their comments on that as we proceed. Man, woof, no coincidences. It was not lost on me. One, that you said you were a first-time caller. Fantastic. So glad that you called in. Don't be nervous. We're all just, or... yeah, well, at least I am a victim of white supremacy. I think we have a lot of victims present. So at any rate, The other thing that was not lost on me, you said you are an expecting mom, and the suspected race soldier wanted to plan your shower. When I was talking about possibilities for being a certified yoga instructor, a listener did mention prenatal yoga. And I said, wow, my tacky suspected racist yoga instructor, she just said that she got a private yoga offering. I mean, private yoga classes, you can, wow, lots of money. Anyway, private yoga class for prenatal yoga. And I thought, wow, I never saw myself doing prenatal yoga, but we did spend a whole section on prenatal modifications. That was on the exam, like what are you not supposed to do and all of that. Like, yeah, I'm supposed to be able to teach a pregnant female. Like, would you be interested in prenatal yoga?
That's something quite interesting. They do offer quite a few classes at hospitals and whatnot. Probably would be. One thing about being pregnant is your ligaments are a bit looser.
Yep.
They do tell you that. And so I know a lot of pregnant women probably feel that need to stretch quite a bit more. You don't want to, but you know you should. So that would be absolutely something I'd be interested in. And I'd want to have a non-white teacher just for comfortability. So I think that's a definite niche for sure.
That is amazing. That was never in my wildest perspective to do prenatal yoga, and they even had Sound Logic. You did all those programs about the stress that Black pregnant mothers are under and things that can be done to help protect them. Prenatal yoga would benefit them. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Add that. So prison, yoga behind bars, yoga retreats, prenatal yoga. That could be a part of the retreat, though. You could easily just combine the two. Prenatal yoga. I forgot all about that. Other people that dialed in, if you have commentary, I'll share a thought or two once I'm able to see the Today Show interview. Other people that dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be here?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Pull up my notes real quick, what I got on. But yes, so congratulations, Gus, on your certification. And Rob, man, I wish you the best, and I'm glad you got my email. Hope to hear from you, and I'm glad that you are out of Milwaukee, and that you're in California. I wish you the best with all of that. As far as, man, black celebrities, it really hurts me when I hear about another black celebrity passing away, because I'm convinced that many of them were murdered, Michael Jackson and some other people. And so it just seems like, not every day, but it just seems like so frequently just black celebrities are just dying. And I think that it has a lot to do with white supremacists taking direct action. I wanted to speak on, I think it was last week, you had a segment on a nigger jokes, and you talked about the Lakers and all of that. I think there's a feces emoji that has eyes on it, and I think that emoji is supposed to represent black people, and I think that's why it has eyes and maybe even nose and lips to, you know, represent people. And just, you know, for white people, just with their tackiness and how they tell jokes against us, and they disrespect us and things of that nature. They talk about fried chicken and watermelon and Kool-Aid and all that type of stuff. And my thing is, you know, we don't have to be bullied, because I think a lot of us are really offended by these things. But the thing is, really, if you compare the two groups, like in my view, white people don't stand up against us. And it's like, so they want to talk about fried chicken and Kool-Aid and watermelon. Ultimately, my thing is, you know, can you even cook any of those things? Can you make Kool-Aid? Can you do any of that? Can you season food? Can you do any of that? You know, and you can even go to, you can Google white people eat, which is three different words, and then lipstick alley, which is one word. And probably the first thing that pops up, it says something about the nasty stuff. It doesn't say stuff. It says the S word that people eat. And you just see just some craziness, just like some Jell-O with some eggs in it and some hot dogs and just some crazy stuff. And I remember one night I was just looking at that and I was just laughing all night. And as far as like the jokes, like I got a white joke. It's not a joke and it's not funny, but I mean, it's real, which is, what do you call a white person? A child rapist. That's the punchline. And then they want to talk about we look like, you know, monkeys and all this and that. Okay, well, you look like an ostrich. And I'd rather look like a monkey than look like an ostrich. You know, and they want to talk about nappy hair. Well, I'd rather have nappy hair than have hair that gets bugs in it, which is, you know, what they get, and it's called lice. And then, you know, you talk about, you know, the skin and all of that. Well, you know, your skin, it ages quickly, and, you know, you can't get in the sun. And just like Dr. Welding said, it's genetic recessive. So it's like there's no debate there when it comes to those things. And you want to talk about we eat chitlins, for an example, you know, every now and then. Okay, well, that's what your skin looks like. So okay, you want to talk about us eating that once a year? Well, that's what you look like every day. And you want to compare our skin to feces? We can compare yours to vomit. And another thing, too, as far as your skin is concerned, just like Dr. Welding's research, her research turned up that, or her research showed that, you know, you're an albino mutant. And so, you know, hashtag watch Welding work. And then you want to talk about the projects. Well, you know, you live in the people who are poor that are white. They live in trailer parks, and which is much worse conditions. You want to make fun of our names like Dandowitz and Monstrosity. You can turn that into monstrosity. We can do any of that. We just really don't have to be bullied. And I wouldn't recommend that anybody use any of these, I guess, responses on the job or anything like that, unless you can do it in a real codified, indirect manner where it doesn't cause you any problems. But those are just things that you can share with other victims, and that you can tell the terrorists these things, I would say, in public, but not necessarily on the job where you could get in trouble, or just for your own mind, so that you don't have to, I guess, feel bad about the things that they say, because they don't really want this debate. Like, there was one situation where a white child called a black child called him a nigger, and the black child responded calling them white trailer trash peckerwood. Well, I'd rather be called a nigger than to be called trash. And that situation ended up where, you know, they were all upset and telling the child, we don't take name calling and all this and that. At the end of the day, they don't want this debate at all. They either get silent, angry, or both. And that's it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Hi. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. This is Draftomania. Gus, I just wanted to call in and say congratulations on your yoga certification. It's really been a journey with all of the shenanigans that have gone on in the classroom. But I just wanted to really congratulate you on that. And make a comment in regards to using the word black. You know, I'm quite sure you know there's a whole group there's the Moors that say that we shouldn't refer to ourselves as black. And as far as the women that are, what do you call them? The immigrants that have been taking care of the kids, and they come from other countries, and they've been au pairs, yeah. When I'm originally from New Jersey, and over in South Orange, New Jersey, which is pretty upper class area. There's a lot of Jewish families that live over in that area. And what they would do is they would get women from South Africa to come over and become nannies, au pairs, for their families. That was one of the most common things. I don't know. I guess they would use agencies and things like that, but they were hiring women from South Africa to come over from South Africa to become au pairs for them. And that's all I had. And I just wanted, like I said, I mainly called just to wish you, congratulate you. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. Thanks to all of the listeners. Cal's listeners not only have been very tolerant of hearing me talk about the different incidents that have happened in and around attending yoga class, but have supported and nabbed yoga items. I got two great yoga mats in my yoga blocks, lots of great yoga material for my class. So Cal's listeners have definitely been super supportive, and hopefully we can hook it up. Cal's counter-racist 10-year anniversary retreat for next year with prenatal yoga. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, callers, listeners. Congratulations on your new certification. I was listening to, as far as the prenatal yoga, that's brilliant. That's very needed. And I've noticed you said if you're in the greater Seattle or Washington area, but I know how you feel about the adjustments, the physical aspect of it. So you may want to even offer video, like Skype, live Skype. You'd be surprised who you can reach across the country as far as the prenatal or instructions that way. But when you were speaking about you and Mr. Fuller's conversation about the word black and how to remove that, I figured you were right on point. And with his response, I get it, but I kind of don't agree with it. But my question is, I'm looking here sitting in my living room and I'm looking at my work boots and they're black and they're like sitting between my feet and they're no way in shape or form any, they're not even close to my complexion as far as my skin color. They're totally different. And from my research through my family, my lineage, I can't find anybody that's come from Africa. And if they did, they weren't black. They, from where we come from on this land, we're indigenous copper color people. So my question to you before I mute my line is, isn't the word or referring to myself or other peoples as African-American or black, isn't that a metaphor? And thank you for taking my call, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. African-American, I didn't say that. I think that might have been said in the segment, but I generally don't use that one. Do I think African-American is a metaphor? I have to think about that. I have to think about that, but because I don't really use that. I have to think about that more because I don't use that word as frequently. Is black a metaphor? I would say at minimum, it's incorrect. If someone wanted to submit that they think it's a metaphor, I probably wouldn't debate them because at minimum, it's incorrect. And I think racists are deliberately referring to victims of white supremacy, the ones that they classify as black. They're doing this deliberately. They know we are not the same complexion as, I forgot what you, I think you said your work boots. That was what it was. Your shoes. As they know we're not the same color as that. So if someone wanted to submit that that's a metaphor, I would not dispute it. But at minimum, it is incorrect what's happening at all based on racism. African-American, you'll have to give me some more time to think about that because I don't use that word as often. Does that answer the question?
Yes, sir, it does. And I thank you for that. But I mean, I just don't understand how you can be both. Either you're African or you're American. You can't be both. You can't be at two places at one time. But that's all I was getting at. But I really do thank you for your consideration of my question. Have a good night. Thanks.
Yes, sir. I had not thought of that either, doing the video. And I think at least one or two people had mentioned that they know of black people, black yogis, who that's what they do, what you just mentioned, sir, the Skype or some form of doing it via online, having the sessions and just having people subscribe or show up and doing the yoga that way. But doing prenatal yoga via online, that's... write that down as well. Thank you kindly. Other folks that we missed completely, if we've not heard from you and you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes.
Oh. I heard Mr. Imhan DC, if you can just give me a bit of patience, sir. The female caller, yes, ma'am.
That was me, but I'm sorry. I had an addendum, but I'm sorry. I'll wait. This read in Nevada. Never mind.
Oh, right on. Imhan DC, he was one of the listeners. I said folks have been so supportive, who was working diligently. He had mentioned it on air, trying to get up to Seattle to get a class and trying to get up this weekend, even after the whites said that we couldn't do guests at the class. He was trying and emailing me trying to get up here, but I'm all certified now, so hopefully whenever folks get here, I will make an effort to have some sort of schedule, let people know if I have the opportunity to teach a class that folks can come and take with Gus. But Imhan DC, much obliged for the effort, sir. Line should be open.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I'm in a noisy environment. But yes, sir. I really, really wanted to make it to that Friday. My the transmission ended up going out, you know, driving from the distance that we drove, and I don't know, you know, I don't know how to, you know, change the transmission yet, but, yes, whenever I do get the chance, I would love to go out there, to Seattle. I also wanted to make mention about the term African American. You know, I don't know. I don't really know what we're going to call it, you know, ourselves. But I would say that I claim this particular land, this continent of North America and South America, and I claim Africa. I have blood from both places, and so I claim the land in both places. And I also say, with the claiming the land and saying that I'm indigenous and saying that I'm not going to give up this land to any other people, you know, we have to be armed. Just in general, all people, all other people are armed. So you have to be armed as a people. And so it should be a mandate that every man, every male child has a weapon of some sort. And then there's a whole lot of different resources as to what weapons are suggested. I've noticed when I was shooting, I wasn't good when I first started shooting at the gun range. I would like shoot down below the target sometimes. Sometimes I would shoot, you know, to either the left or the right. And then I found out, I kept practicing and learned how to shoot, but it was rather expensive. My baby brothers have BB guns, you know, growing up. And so whenever I finally allowed them to shoot, they were shooting on target. So then BB guns is, or some type of cheap gun often could help save money and also allow you to train and practice on your aim. With Mr. Neely Fuller, I agree with most of his work. What I don't agree with is, whether we should go out of our way to make sure people remain on the planet as albinos or albinos. I don't know how that would be productive. I don't know how that would be productive to not make white people stop spraying chemtrails because the sun could negatively affect them if they did stop. I don't think, because I had that conversation with Mr. Neely Fuller, and he didn't, maybe I misunderstood what he was saying. But I just don't agree with, going out of our way to try to make sure that a group of people can live in areas that they genetically wouldn't be able to live in if they were not, I guess what you call terraforming or blocking the sun and doing other harmful things to black people, Well, anyway, so those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Much obliged, good sir. Sorry to hear about the transportation issues. Heard some more of that over the weekend. That is, especially with all, Seattle is like really far from everywhere significant. I realize that when I speak to folks who are wherever they are on the map, that Seattle is generally speaking not close to anything. It is generally very far from everybody. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, sorry about that, guys. How's it going, everyone? This is Black Male Engineer. I just kind of tuned in, and I didn't hear any of the clips, really. I do have a question I want to pose to everyone. I'm trying to understand, why do white people practice racism? Is it because, they just have to? Why in particular? So at work, a couple months ago, I talked about I was denied a promotion at work, and that promotion was withheld for about a year. And then I just found out this week that was actually illegal. They can't do that legally. So now I'm seeing about taking legal action and trying to get back pay plus compensation for that action. But just blatant illegal activities, this is just normal thing that I see at work. And last thing I wanted to talk about was I was watching the news about South Africa and how President Ramaphosa wants to remove, pretty much take land away from white people without paying them. And it's just interesting how that situation is going on in that side of the world. And we don't really hear about it here. But America, they take a lot of platinum and gold and a lot of minerals from South Africa. So if these group of black people, if they really get the land back, I want to see what type of resurgence of Donald Trump Nazi action we might see, because that's pretty interesting. A group of black people being able to just remove white people from power, in a particular country with a lot of money, and that's all.
Just prompting about those metaphors, when we were speaking about Omarosa earlier, I said, why are you grilling me at the 10-minute mark? Why are you still aggressively asking me questions, prompting even myself? And then more recently, thank you very much.
You're breaking up.
You're breaking up really bad, Gus. You're breaking up really bad.
Let's see. Am I being heard, or am I still breaking up?
It's very, very break. It's breaking up pretty bad.
All right, let's see. Am I coming in clear, or is it still breaking up?
Much better.
Okay. Much obliged. Thank you kindly. The other clarity, the metaphor when you were talking about the situation in South Africa, which people should be trying to get information on, myself included, you said the resurgence of Donald Trump or Adolf Hitler type of racism. I'm paraphrasing, but that would be a metaphor. And the reason that I point that out is I do think it's important to be specific in what we mean, because sometimes those types of phrasing sentences or our thoughts in that manner, it's not specific. It's not detailed. It's not exact, precise. And that's what we need to work on, increasing precision with words. Word Masters started the broadcast with that. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open.
Hey, is my line open?
Oh. Yes, ma'am. The female caller who just asked if your line is open. I think I heard two other people as well.
All right. Hi, everyone. This is caller from the 712. I was listening to the reports here. And the first thing I wanted to address, just like last week, that white people do not care about children. With the au pair article, they don't want to sit down and care for the children. They would rather be off at work. Or with the second case with the drug addict lady, she refuses to stop doing the drugs. The drugs make the baby calm down in her stomach, so she does not care about children, and they don't care about children, even though they try to front like they do. And Gus, I wanted to ask you, since you said you listened to NPR, and I listen to it too, I was wondering, did you hear that report on how South Africa is supposed to be the rape capital of the world?
Wow, was that from this week?
Yeah, I heard it driving around. They interviewed an African woman, and, you know, they said a lot about rape, and then she let the interviewer know, you know, this all stems from colonialism. This all stems from us being taught since colonial times that violence is the only way to deal with anything, and rape is the only way to deal with anything when you're having issues. And so she let the interviewer know that. I thought you might have heard that. It was a good one.
I would have probably included that in the audio segments. I'll have to find it and share. Thank you for alerting me to look for that.
Yep. And then somebody mentioned that Ben Tillman book. They're listening to it right now. That was a great read. Everybody should read that. It's slow in the beginning, but it gives you background on his family. And with President Donald Trump, I think he was either reading that book when he was campaigning, or somebody gave him the line out of the book maybe, but he said a line from the Ben Tillman book when Ben Tillman, I believe it was either Ben Tillman or one of his family members said that they could stand in the middle of the street and shoot someone and nothing would happen because they're so popular amongst the people. And so that is a good read. Everybody should go back and listen to that. And another one is White People with Genitals. Since you were talking about the horse and the shadow, Mr. Fuller and everything, White People with Genitals, they have a very unhealthy, like they don't think when it comes to genitals, the white men like to, you know, pull out their penis and pee on people. We heard about that from the Mandela book, and y'all probably seen that. There's what did Thomas say about the toilets just right out in Paris, you know? So again, white men wanted to pull their penis out. The horse's genitals, that poor horse. And so me and my family was just, I don't even know how we got on this subject, but we were researching they're called capone cockerels or roosters, C-A-P-O-N. And so white people have found out that if you cut these roosters' testes off, they will get fatter, and the meat of the capone is supposed to be so good because they sat there and cut the testicles off of the capone. And so just horrible. And then the another caller stated something about, he was talking about the au pairs and how he doesn't really see white women caring or pushing around black babies. Now, I don't know, they're probably not caring for these children, but I see that a lot where I am, because a lot of the people, the black men, like to have sex and impregnate the white women around here. So that's what I see all day. They're pushing around black babies, faking like they're caring for black babies. And that's all my commentary for today. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged. I will look for the NPR report on rape. The urinating on other people. We did hear that in Madiba, Nelson Mandela's autobiography. We also heard that in Chris Kyle, American Sniper, autobiography that we also read on the context of white supremacy at the beginning of 2015. That was a few months before we got to Ben Tillman and the reconstruction of white supremacy. And since it's been mentioned so many times, I had almost forgotten yours truly, Gus T, narrated that book. So if you tune in, you'll get an extra cheat, Gus T narrating Ben Tillman's work. Other folks that we've not heard from at all.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Well, good evening, 2812 from Virginia. Hope everybody's having a good day. A couple quick observations. Last week on a radio broadcast that I do in Charlottesville, we interviewed Heather Heyer's mother, similar to, I think, the clip that Gus played last week with the quote-unquote anniversary of the domestic terrorist attack that happened last weekend, a year ago. And what was interesting was that I came in and I was listening to the interview because they taped it on a Friday, and the rest of the all non-white people, specifically black male, black female that are on the broadcast team, they were interviewing her, and they got to the point to where she was talking about being an ally for black people. And she was just saying, oh, you know, I'm here and I'm for the cause, and Heather was for the cause too. And someone asked her in an abbreviated form of the question that Gus typically likes to ask white people, which is, are white people conscious that they are practicing racism? And she said, when she was answering the question, she said, yeah, well, you know, a lot of white people are just, you know, they're just confused. And then I looked down, and mind you, this is being taped. She changed her answer, and she said, no, let me be honest. Most white people are very aware that they are being racist and stuff like that. And everyone in the room got excited, and I said, well, we just need to remember. And obviously, I didn't do anything special. I said, we should not be congratulating or applauding a white person for telling us the truth. And that was a very, very interesting interview. I also had a person that I work with that called me on Friday, and they were complaining about, I had called in maybe about a year and a half ago about my boss that was sleeping, suspected white supremacist in front of my face. Now this black female is having an issue with him. Apparently she has a customer that has a very, I just like to call a black name, and there are people in our office that are making fun of her, and she just asked me for advice. And because of the cows, I was able to also help her and tell her, you know, if they mention something about her name, you need to be very serious and say, hey, We're trying to close a mortgage loan for this young lady. I do not think we should be discussing her name. And if it happens again, she needs to report it. And the last thing is that I'm reading a book right now called The Color of Money by Richard Rothstein. It's a good, I don't want to say good book. It is a book filled with lots of great information of how white people practiced racism in the area of, I'll call it housing, because he talks about segregation. But one observation that I made that a lot of white authors, even though he calls himself a Jew, is that they don't like to mention names of specific people that were doing certain things. Because all throughout this book, he says things like laws or zoning, but white people were in charge of a lot of these things, and they never, ever want to give someone a specific name. They like to say the system or things of that nature, but they never just want to say Jim Johnson was the head of such and such, and these were his team members, and this is how they were practicing racism. And I've seen a lot of cases to where in other books and other forms of articles, that's how white people practice racism. And I'll be my line. Thanks, Gus.
No snitching. Other folks we've not heard from at all. If you have a commentary to share, line should be open. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Mr. Steele, yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, California. And I want to say, you know, congratulations to Gus for getting his white validation certificate to teach yoga. I really do encourage you to explore all of the avenues with which you can make money in this area, and also understand that there is a lot more money in scaling your operations than there is in giving one-on-one sessions. The more time that you're spending doing all sorts of yoga, that could be spent doing other things. If you can find a way to license your yoga services, then just as the people who sold you your certification have, perhaps there could be an avenue where you could make a tremendous amount of money. I'll go ahead and say that I think that all victims of racism ought to pay very close attention to Omarosa and the performances that she's giving on the various programs that she's appearing on. She's just giving a clinic on how to deal with racists who are operating at a very high level. Understand that she's at a tremendous amount of risk in the activities that she's partaking in. More specifically, I saw an interview with her on MSNBC, and I noticed that as she was very carefully choosing her words and in discussing what she could reveal, I think that it was, if you're paying very close attention, she appeared to be very, very frightened to say the wrong thing. And she made it very clear that she's dealing with very sensitive information. And the level of courage that she's displaying by revealing all that she has seen and all that she's recorded and all that she has documented, I think it's tremendous. I think that she's putting herself at a tremendous amount of risk. I think that I wouldn't be surprised to see her drowned in a pool, or you know, in a deadly car crash or something very unfortunate. But the sacrifice that she's made specifically to not even parsing her words, just, you know, getting the recordings necessary to be able to declare Donald Trump a racist, even to the admission of other white people, other racists, I think it's tremendous. So, you know, all of this, you know, coon of the month or coon of the year or whatever that people were doing in the past. I think that we need to get past that. I think that we need to realize that we are at a war, and what Omarosa did is an act of war, honestly. And that's how the racists are taking it. And that's how they're going to treat her. And I think that her sacrifice should be respected. And I'll go ahead and mute my line.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Other folks that we've not heard from at all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. And congratulations to you as well, Gus, for the for becoming a certified yoga instructor. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Really quick with the, I think that was the black student. I think they were trying to go to court and they kept rescheduling the hearing, I believe that's what the report said. And that kind of seemed like it was coinciding with that report from last week of how they keep, I guess, rescheduling either misdemeanor cases or felony cases. But I guess on this one, they were saying that they prioritize the felony cases. And I think they practice racism with that at times, subjecting victims to be prone to commit crimes to get them in greater confinement. But that was very interesting how they still let the suspected racist or race soldier, he was still able to graduate and he was transferred. I think that word was used. And that quote from Nellie Fuller, white people don't get fired, they get transferred. I think that's another example. The next one was with, I think it's Omarosa, is it Manigault Newman, I believe. I wanted to also try and get that name in there. The phrasing that the news reports from this week, the comments from suspected racist Donald Trump, he called a dog, and I don't even think he's referred to any of the other people he had conflict with. I think even Eminem even wrote a rap verse about him, and he didn't even give any response. But the term bite the hand that feeds you, I don't know if anybody heard that term used in the news media, but I heard it constantly. And I connected that with the word dog. So I think that was a lot of the white people in the news media practicing racism. She bit the hand that fed her, you know, bite the hand that feeds you. They kept repeating that phrase. And as far as I think that was NPR, where they were talking about giving white supremacists a platform. And I noticed that the phrasing of, well, why do we want to give them a platform to speak on? And that's just what they want. We're giving them what they want, almost like it's some kind of a fear that they don't want to approach talking about something that's connected to racism. And I guess that's one of the most overt forms that, for the most part, they can only refer to. But I think that's a very skilled way of practicing racism. And that's the only comment that I have for now. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Have you shared yet, sir?
Yes, sir, I have. Hang on one second.
Okay, if you can hang on one second, because we have not too much time, and we do have some people who didn't get to share at all. Let's see. Retired
firefighter. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Instructor Gus.
Greetings.
And everybody else. I just going to take this brief time to read something on Aretha Franklin. That I think is constructive, and also it shows a tremendous amount of self-respect on her behalf. Do I have permission?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the title, Aretha says she'll go Angela's bond if permitted. Soul Queen Aretha Franklin says she stands ready to go Angela Davis bond, whether it's $100,000 or $250,000, if the courts will let her. Ms. Davis, 26-year-old former UCLA philosophy instructor and an admitted communist, is being held in New York without bond pending extradition to San Rafael, California, where a Marion County grand jury returned murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy indictments against her in connection with a courtroom escape attempt that took four lives. Ms. Davis was accused of buying the guns that were used in the abortive attempt to free three prisoners. Ms. Franklin said, "My daddy," which is Detroit's Reverend C.L. Franklin, "says I don't know what I'm doing. Well, I respect him, of course, but I'm going to stick by my beliefs. Angela Davis must go free. Black people will be free. I've been locked up for disturbing the peace in Detroit, and I know you got to disturb the peace when you can't get no peace. Jail is hell to be in. I'm going to see her free if there is any justice in our courts, not because I believe in communism, but because she's a black woman and she wants freedom for black people. I have the money. I got it from black people. They've made me financially able to have it, and I want to use it in ways that will help our people." That article, as you probably figure it out, was written probably in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And it gives an excellent account of Ms. Franklin and her legacy. We also know that her voice was like a musical instrument in itself. I grew up listening to her music a lot, of course, just like a lot of other people. And just wanted to read that article because it kind of like exemplifies her other than her singing. She was a type of person that you'll go into the grocery store and Miss Franklin would be shopping in the grocery store. She didn't have bodyguards and, you know, the things that the frills that people have in their quote unquote celebrity status. The word, last but not least, the word African, the term African-American, very confusing term. Former Secretary of State with the Clinton administration. What was his name? John Kerry. John Kerry, from my understanding, his wife, which was a white female, was born in Africa. She migrated into this part of the world and became a quote-unquote American citizen. That technically makes her an African-American. That's what all I have to say about that term, African-American. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Indeed, indeed. I'm not sure if we nabbed everyone, but we are substantially over the three-hour mark. If we missed any folks, that would be my fault. I think I navigated and got most of the hands. At least I'm not seeing any glaring hands up. But hopefully we nabbed everybody who had a hand up. If we missed you, my apologies. I will definitely do better next weekend. Yoga teacher training is done and again finished a day early, so I have my Sunday back to prep and get ready for broadcasts coming up this week. You can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com if you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes. Once I get the email for Book TV, I'll post that link and any other constructive content that was mentioned on the broadcast during the course of the evening. Just check Black Talk Radio Network.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
I sent the Book TV. Awesome. I sent it already.
Awesome.
I hope you have it.
Thank you so much. I will share with Listeners, Barracoon will be back for this Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, normal time for the book club. Again, check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook for updates for the upcoming broadcast. iTunes and some of the other platforms had not updated with regards to the archives for about a week or so. There were some of the programs, some of the most like recent content had not uploaded, but that should be corrected. We should be current up to today's broadcast. That should be uploaded within an hour or so. If you have any problems with that, you can just drop an email. With that, much obliged to everyone who participated. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Be safe, be codified. If you're going to be out enjoying the last few weeks of summer, grand. I'm hoping to do so myself tomorrow. Still be codified. Race soldiers, they do not pause just because we're having a little fun in the summer sun. Sobriety would certainly be best under conditions of white supremacy. Dr. Welsing and many of the other folks that we esteem would strongly encourage, let's reject all of white's toxins, poisons. Let's take excellent care of our brain computer so that we can think and come up with new concepts, solutions to the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. In addition to being sober, each and every time we are in a vehicle, let's be buckled up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.